Stolen Words, The Literary Crime of the Century. Copyright December 2025, Jagannath Mishra Das, www.lightofdharma.com. This work would not have been possible without the grace and guidance of my spiritual masters, whose teachings continue to illuminate the path of devotion and scholarship. I am deeply grateful to Srila A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Prabhupada for his original translation and commentary of the Bhagavad Gita as it is, which remains an invaluable gift to the world. Special thanks to the scholars, devotees, and researchers who have contributed their insights and expertise to verify the accuracy of this analysis. Your commitment to truth and authenticity has been indispensable. To my family and friends who supported this endeavor with patience and understanding throughout the research and writing process, your encouragement sustained this work. Finally, I acknowledge all those who seek to preserve the sacred integrity of spiritual texts for future generations. May this work serve that noble purpose. In 1972, A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Prabhupada gave the world his Bhagavad Gita as it is, a devotional translation that would introduce millions to Krishna consciousness. After his passing in 1977, some disciples decided to improve his work. This book documents what happened next. This story reveals what happens when an author's work is thoroughly rewritten after his death and published under the same title, as if it were the original. Not a new edition, with changes clearly marked, not a scholarly update with transparent records, but a wholesale substitution that altered the author's words throughout while claiming to enhance them. It could have been the Bible, the Quran, the Tao Te Ching. It happened to the Bhagavad Gita. And because the original survived, we can observe the mechanics. How posthumous revisions replace primary sources, how authors' intentions get overwritten by editors' preferences, how institutions betray the very texts they exist to protect. If you care about textual authenticity, authorial integrity, or how language shapes human consciousness, this investigation concerns you. When comparing Prabhupada's original 1972 edition with the posthumous 1983 revision, one might expect minor editorial differences. What emerges is evidence of extensive doctrinal transformation, alterations that fundamentally restructure how readers encounter the divine, understand transcendent reality, and develop consciousness. Since Prabhupada had passed away in 1977, he could not consent to these changes. Readers were never informed, and these alterations continue to shape millions of lives today. These are not merely academic concerns. The differences create distinct sacred trajectories. Readers of the original develop intimate devotional consciousness through grace-dependent transformation. Readers of the revision develop methodical religious practices through knowledge-based progression. These findings will disturb those who prefer sacred matters remain abstract and unexamined. It will challenge institutions that conflate religious authority with editorial authority. It will confront individuals who dismiss textual precision as unimportant to sacred life. This book makes no apologies for that disturbance. Specific names are not mentioned because this subject matter is highly inflammable, with two distinct camps holding strong positions. However, all these changes and claims can be quickly substantiated through internet searches. This data is publicly available throughout the web for independent verification. When sacred texts undergo wholesale alteration, the consequences extend far beyond publishing decisions. They reshape human consciousness itself. The proof is clear. The implications of these changes cannot be ignored. How readers respond is their choice alone. This investigation uses narrative storytelling to present factual evidence. Character names and specific anecdotes are fictionalized to illustrate verified patterns, but the data is factual and verifiable. Fictional narrative characters include Maya Rodriguez, Dr. Sarah Chen, David Matthews, and temple community members whose experiences are composites drawn from recorded testimonies. However, all scientific studies cited are authentic peer-reviewed research from real academics, Pascual Leone, Beauregard, Paquette, Newberg, DeQuilly, and others. All verse comparisons, chapter statistics, textual changes, and Prabhupada's recorded class transcripts can be independently verified through publicly available sources, including ascitus.com for the 1972 edition, vedabase.io for the revised edition, and bookchanges.com documentation. The story begins with the book that does not exist, though millions have read it. Or perhaps one should say the book that exists twice, wearing the same name like a medieval forgery that has replaced its original so completely that scholars debate which edition came first. Yet the end of this story makes no sense at its beginning, and so we must start elsewhere. It was November 14, 1977, in Vrindavan, India, the holy land where Krishna danced 5,000 years ago, when A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Prabhupada spoke his last recorded words. Not, as legend would later claim, Hare Krishna, but something far more revealing. Meri kuch ichha nahin. I have no desires. A strange final statement for a man who had spent the last 12 years of his life possessed by a singular desire, to give the Western world his translation of the Bhagavad Gita exactly as he understood it. But to understand the mystery of the book that exists twice, we must first understand what Prabhupada believed he was creating. The Bhagavad Gita, literally Song of God, unfolds as a battlefield conversation between the warrior Arjuna and his charioteer Krishna, who reveals himself, verse by verse, as the Supreme Divine. 700 verses. 5,000 years of spiritual guidance. And until 1972, a barrier of Sanskrit that kept Western understanding at bay. Here was Prabhupada's radical departure. He claimed no scholarly credentials by Western standards, yet promised something no academic would dare. Not a translation of words, but a transmission of consciousness. Where scholars saw philosophy requiring analysis, he offered devotion requiring only surrender. His Bhagavad Gita as it is bore a title that was simultaneously humble and audacious, as it is. No interpretation, no scholarly mediation, pure transmission from teacher to student, as practiced for millennia. The audacity succeeded. From 1972 to 1977, those 5 years when Prabhupada was still among us, the book sold steadily across America, Europe, and eventually into languages we cannot pronounce. University professors, initially skeptical of a Hindu text by an unknown author, adopted it for courses. Readers reported transformations that academic translations had never triggered. The Macmillan Publishing House watched their sales figures climb, though they could not explain why this particular version of an ancient text had struck something resonant in Western consciousness. And Prabhupada? He spent those final 5 years traveling, teaching, and, most crucially for our investigation, carefully guarding his book's integrity. Every translation personally reviewed, every edition personally approved, every error personally corrected. His disciples remember him saying, "My books will be the law books for the next 10,000 years." His books were his legacy, the gift that would outlive his physical presence. He left behind 5,000 disciples, 108 temples spanning 6 continents, and, most importantly, his books, exactly as he wanted them, preserved for millennia, untouchable, or so everyone believed. The mystery begins 6 years after his death in 1983, when the Bhaktivedanta Book Trust published what they called a revised and enlarged edition of the Bhagavad Gita as it is. The phrase revised and enlarged should have been the first signal that something was amiss. How does one revise a book that claimed to present things as they are? The year 1983 should have passed unremarkably in the annals of spiritual publishing. Instead, it marks the moment when what we might call the Great Substitution began, though, of course, no one called it that at the time. Picture the scene. 6 years after Prabhupada's passing away, the Bhaktivedanta Book Trust quietly releases this new edition. No fanfare, no explanation to readers. Same title, same author's name, same promise of authenticity. Inside, however, a transformation had occurred that would fracture spiritual communities across 6 continents, though it would take 20 years for anyone to notice. The method was elegantly simple. Bookstores replaced old stock with new. Libraries shelved revisions where originals had been. New readers encountered what they believed to be the same book that had transformed the previous generation. The perfect crime, if crime it was. And that, dear reader, is the question that torments this investigation. Consider the mathematics of deception. More than 3/4 of the verses altered. In percentage terms, and how modern our age has become, reducing mystery to statistics, 77% of verses modified, not edited, not improved, altered. Which raises the philosophical question, at what point does revision become replacement? The medieval philosophers would have called this the ship of Theseus problem, though they were concerned with wooden planks, not. Who authorized these changes? Here we encounter our first puzzle. Prabhupada was gone. His final words, "I have no desires," fading like incense smoke in Vrindavan. Dead authors cannot authorize. Dead authors cannot forbid. Dead authors become, in Bartha's famous phrase, simply dead, and the text becomes an orphan seeking new parents. Who made these changes? The answer leads us to Jayadvaita Swami, one of Prabhupada's original disciples, a man who had helped produce the very books he would later transform. The irony is almost medieval. The guardian becomes the changer, the preserver becomes the innovator. But to call Jayadvaita a villain would miss the intricate complexity of his position. He believed, sincerely we must assume, that he was serving his guru by perfecting what had been left imperfect. Why make these changes? Here the story becomes not complex, but Byzantine. The editors possessed manuscripts, dictation tapes, recorded conversations, an archive of intentions. They thought they were correcting errors, not changing philosophy. But intent, as we know from jurisprudence, does not determine consequence. What they created was not correction, but transformation. Not perfection, but alteration. And the most subtle alteration was the one that would prove most significant, a systematic shift in the divine voice itself, alteration so delicate that only the most careful reader would notice how Krishna's words were introduced differently, how the original's invitation to personal devotion became the revision's demand for methodical understanding. For 20 years, the substitution remained undetected. Then the internet arrived, making comparison possible for the first time, and the discovery began. The story properly begins not with the crime, but with its detection. And the detective was not a senior scholar, but a doctoral candidate in religious studies at Stanford named Maya Rodriguez. She had completed her coursework and passed her qualifying exams, achieving ABD, all but dissertation status, and was in the early stages of her dissertation research when she discovered by accident what the Bhaktivedanta Book Trust had hidden by design. Her background in comparative religion, her academic training in textual analysis, and her access to Stanford's research resources would prove essential, though she could never have anticipated that a simple question from her hospitalized grandmother would launch an investigation that would ultimately replace her planned dissertation entirely. The question was innocent enough. Can you explain this verse? Every detective story begins with an anomaly, some small disturbance in the expected order of things that reveals, upon investigation, an entire hidden world. Maya Rodriguez's anomaly was verse 6.31 of the Bhagavad Gita, which she had been reading every morning for 15 years. The words had shaped her daily meditation, her understanding of divine relationship, her approach to spiritual practice. They were as familiar to her as her own name. On a Tuesday morning in the spring of 2023, while visiting her grandmother, recently hospitalized with an illness that doctors were calling serious, Maya discovered that her grandmother had been reading different words entirely. "Can you explain this verse, Miha?" the elderly woman asked, her voice weak but urgent. She pointed to verse 6.31 in her worn 1972 edition. "It doesn't say what I remember anymore. I got a new copy from the temple, and look, the words are completely different." Maya took both books, her grandmother's original and the temple's recent printing, and held them side by side. Same chapter, same verse number, same Sanskrit text at the top. Sarva bhuta sthitam yumam bhajati, ekatvam astita sarvatha vartamano, pisayoga mayi vartate. But the English translations below were not merely different, they conveyed fundamentally opposite paths. Same author's name embossed on the cover, drastically different spiritual focus. Her grandmother's 1972 edition read, "The yogi who knows that I and the supersoul within all creatures are one worships me and remains always in me in all circumstances." Maya's current edition read, "Such a yogi who engages in the worshipful service of the supersoul, knowing that I and the supersoul are one, remains always in me in all circumstances." Picture that moment. Maya holding two books with identical titles, identical author attributions. But inside, as if some cosmic practical joke were being played on the very concept of textual authority, a complete reversal of spiritual direction. Her grandmother's version spoke of direct personal worship, worships me. An intimate relationship between devotee and divine person. Maya's version redirected that worship away from the personal God to the supersoul, transforming intimate devotion into impersonal meditation. Same Sanskrit, same verse number, fundamentally different instruction. That morning began an investigation. Though Maya was no detective, merely a granddaughter trying to understand why someone had altered her spiritual inheritance without her knowledge. What she would discover would reveal what may be the most successful literary substitution in modern spiritual history. A silent transformation, executed so smoothly that millions of readers remain unaware they have been given different books. That same afternoon, sitting in her grandmother's hospital room with both books spread before her, Maya began what she naively thought would be a simple comparison to reassure her grandmother. Perhaps the temple had made a printing error. Perhaps there was some rational explanation. Within hours, she found herself in a labyrinth that would have impressed Borges himself. Discrepancies emerged that made her hands tremble, not from fear, but from the vertigo of discovering that what she had believed to be solid ground was actually an elaborate construction. This initial comparison revealed enough discrepancies to convince Maya that something deliberate was occurring. But she had no idea of the scope. That would require months of painstaking research. This was not editing. This was not improvement. This was ideological reconstruction wearing the mask of scholarship. The first discovery was the most pervasive, that alteration in the divine voice I mentioned earlier. 22 times throughout the 700 verses, whenever Krishna spoke, the original presented him as the Blessed Lord, intimate, personal. The revision replaced this with the Supreme Personality of Godhead, formal, hierarchical, not a translation choice, but a relationship choice. The editors had not improved the text. They had redirected the reader's spiritual orientation from the personal to the hierarchical. Maya felt this in her bones before any neuroscientist would explain it. These were consciousness choices masquerading as editorial decisions. What she discovered next revealed the global scope of what had occurred. Moscow temples split over conflicting verses, congregants discovering their memorized scriptures contradicted their children's. São Paulo translators found themselves paralyzed by version choices. Which Bhagavad Gita was authentic. German professors found contradictory student citations. Same author, same title, different words. Everywhere, readers awakening to discover their sacred text had been transformed without their knowledge, consent, or even awareness. The internet, that modern library of Babel, revealed testimonies from across the globe. A London devotee. When I quoted memorized verses, newer students said I was wrong. Same verse, different words. A Toronto professor. My dissertation quotes don't match current editions. Which version is accurate when both claim to be the same book? The questions multiplied like reflections in opposing mirrors, each one revealing the dizzying depth of the deception. Maya compiled the mathematics of the transformation she was analyzing. But numbers are symbols before they are quantities. The true revelation lay not in the magnitude, but in the method. The changes followed three distinct patterns, each revealing a different aspect of what Maya began to think of as consciousness archaeology, the deliberate excavation and replacement of one type of spiritual awareness with another. The pattern of title changes. The most verified change involved how Krishna is introduced when speaking. 22 times throughout the text, intimate blessing-centered language was transformed into formal hierarchical titles. The pattern of accessibility. Obliteration. Simple English became technical terminology. Where Prabhupada had written for the heart of any reader, the taxi driver, the housewife, the searching college student, the revision demanded philosophical credentials. Steadfast in yoga became equipoised. In 2.13, the self-realized soul became a sober person. Each change defensible in isolation, but collectively transforming the book from devotional guide to academic requirement. The pattern of conditional insertion. Most subtly, descriptions of eternal relationships gained qualifications that transformed unconditional connection into conditional achievement. The soul was no longer simply God's eternal fragmental part, but eternal fragmental part, although struggling hard with the mind and senses. Grace became effort. Gift became attainment. Love became laboratory. Her next discovery was perhaps more disturbing than the alterations themselves: an effective organizational silence. No addition indicated revision. No introduction explained alterations. Libraries cataloged them identically. Bookstores sold them as the same work. The machinery had made comparison nearly impossible, ensuring that new readers would never know they were choosing between two fundamentally different devotional worlds. The question consuming Maya was deceptively simple. Who decided to rewrite a dead author's work, and why did they hide it for 4 decades? The answer would require archaeological excavation into the layers of spiritual authority, editorial ethics, and the metaphysical power of words to shape human consciousness. But to understand how sacred text could be transformed in secret, Maya realized, she first had to understand the extraordinary circumstances under which it was originally created. What Maya discovered next would prove more disturbing than the alterations themselves. The very circumstances that made Prabhupada's translation so miraculous, created under impossible conditions by an elderly monk with limited resources, would later be weaponized to justify its destruction. The disciples who rewrote their teacher's work would claim they were merely finishing what he couldn't complete. But the evidence Maya found in archives and recordings would reveal something far more troubling. Prabhupada had completed exactly what he intended. The transformation came later, when he could no longer object. Every mystery contains within it another mystery, nested like Russian dolls. The mystery of how the Bhagavad Gita came to be rewritten conceals within it the deeper mystery of how it came to be written in the first place, under circumstances so extraordinary that they would later provide both the inspiration and the justification for its transformation. Picture this: Abhay Charande, 69 years old, alone on the cargo ship Jaladuta in August 1965, carrying nothing but 40 rupees, approximately $7, a trunk of Sanskrit books, and a mission that had inspired him for 30 years. His spiritual master had charged him with the impossible: bring Krishna consciousness to the English-speaking world. 3 decades later, with failing health and no prospects, he was finally attempting what younger men would have called suicide. The Atlantic Ocean nearly accomplished what age and poverty could not. 2 heart attacks struck him mid-voyage, alone in his cabin while the ship rolled through storms. He survived by doing the thing he knew best how to do, chanting Sanskrit verses and writing poetry. "I am coming to America empty-handed," he wrote, "but I have faith in your holy name." The poem reads like a man's final testament, not his arrival announcement. September 19, 1965. The Jaladuta docks at a Brooklyn pier in New York. Abhay Charan, now A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Prabhupada, steps onto American soil. He later recalled walking off the ship onto the pier. "I did not know whether to turn left or right. No destination, no clear plan, utterly alone in a foreign country." He travels to Butler, Pennsylvania, to stay with his sponsors Gopal and Sally Agarwal, a businessman and his American wife who had offered their home as his first foreign sanctuary. Little money. English so heavily accented that Americans strained to understand him. But he possessed something that money could not purchase: absolute conviction that 5,000-year-old wisdom could transform the consciousness of a civilization that had never heard of Krishna. What followed reads like urban mythology. An elderly Indian mystic in the Bowery, surrounded by drug addicts and alcoholics, offering 5,000-year-old mantras to hippies seeking truth through LSD. While American intellectuals debated the death of God, he taught street kids to dance for Krishna. The contrast was so absurd it could only be true. But the real mystery occurred after midnight. Every night at 12:30 a.m., Prabhupada would begin the work that would later justify both devotion and controversy: translating the Bhagavad Gita. His method revealed much about why his books would eventually become the center of a 40-year controversy. The process was ritualistic, almost alchemical. First, he would chant each Sanskrit verse repeatedly until its rhythm entered his consciousness. Not memorization, but embodiment. Then came the Roman transliteration, followed by word-for-word meanings. Only after this did he create the English translation, treating it not as linguistic exercise but as devotional meditation. Finally, his purports, elaborate commentaries that often exceeded the verses themselves in length and certainly in passion. Howard Wheeler, Hayagriva to the devotees, served as his principal editor from 1966 to 1967, along with various disciples who typed his dictations. Picture the scene. Prabhupada dictating while pacing his tiny room, hands clasped behind his back, eyes often closed, channeling words from another world into American English. Sometimes he would pause mid-sentence, wave his hand dismissively, and declare, "No, that word doesn't capture Krishna's mood. Write this instead." Here was the first crack in what would later become a chasm. Young American disciples struggling to transcribe his Bengali-accented English, often misunderstood. One night, Prabhupada dictated, "The Supreme Lord is situated in everyone's heart." The typist wrote, "The Supreme Lord is situated in everyone's art." Prabhupada caught this particular error during review, but with thousands of pages and limited time, others slipped through. These errors would later become ammunition. Here was Prabhupada's radical insight. His priority was not academic precision, but consciousness transmission. When disciples suggested more scholarly language to gain university credibility, he dismissed the idea with characteristic bluntness. Where is the difficulty to understand? By misinterpretation, they'll write volumes of books and spoil the whole thing. He had witnessed decades of scholars obscuring the Gita's message in academic complexity. His mission was different. If even one sincere reader could be transformed, he considered his labor successful. This philosophy would later become the battlefield. Every translation choice reflected it. Where Sanskrit offered multiple English possibilities, Prabhupada consistently chose the heart over the head, accessibility over accuracy. He selected words that evoked emotional connection rather than scholarly precision. Yoga etymologically meant linking with the Supreme, but he simplified it to devotional service because service was something Americans could understand. The impossible occurred in 1968. Macmillan Publishers, one of America's most prestigious academic houses, agreed to print an abridged edition. When Brahmananda, one of Prabhupada's early disciples, went to Macmillan's New York offices to deliver a record album, he happened to meet James O'Shea Wade, senior editor. Seizing the moment, Brahmananda mentioned his guru's Bhagavad Gita translation. Wade's response was unexpected. "We've just published a full line of spiritual books, and we were looking for a Bhagavad Gita to fill out the set." Wade agreed to publish it without even seeing the manuscript. A serendipitous encounter that would bring ancient wisdom to Western readers in a way academic translations had not. What Macmillan did not realize was that they were publishing a spiritual methodology disguised as a translation. The abridged edition's success created a demand for the impossible, the complete work. By 1972, Macmillan was prepared to publish 1,008 pages of Sanskrit verses, English translations, and elaborate commentaries, a project that would have terrified academic translators. Prabhupada spent months in obsessive review, every page, every verse, every word scrutinized. His disciples would read passages aloud while he listened with eyes closed, occasionally interrupting, "Read that again." If something didn't capture the precise spiritual mood he intended, he corrected it instantly. The 1972 first edition represented exactly what Prabhupada envisioned. Ancient wisdom rendered in accessible English, scholarly enough for university adoption, yet simple enough to transform any sincere reader. He achieved this through choices that would, 11 years later, provide justification for their own systematic reversal. Krishna consistently addressed as the Blessed Lord, creating personal relationship rather than formal distance. Technical Sanskrit terminology minimized in favor of English equivalents that conveyed feeling over scholarship. Devotional mood prioritized over philosophical precision. Complex metaphysical concepts explained through practical examples rather than abstract theory. From 1972 to 1977, this version touched millions of lives. Letters arrived daily. Prisoners discovering rehabilitation, students finding purpose, housewives experiencing mysticism in suburban kitchens. The book was not merely communicating philosophy. It was transmitting the consciousness of its author across linguistic and cultural barriers that had stood for millennia. In his final months, Prabhupada's concern for his books intensified to the point of obsession. 3 months before his passing, he discovered unauthorized alterations in another publication and erupted in fury that shocked his disciples. his final recorded instruction regarding his texts has become the most disputed sentence in modern spiritual publishing. "Whatever I have written, you should read as it is. Don't change. If there is grammatical discrepancy, you may correct it, but don't change the idea." Present during this instruction was Jayadvaita Swami, the young disciple who had helped produce the original books. His interpretation of the phrase "grammatical discrepancy" would reshape devotional lives for generations and provide the philosophical foundation for what Maya would later discover. November 14, 1977, Vrindavan, India. Prabhupada spoke his final words, "I have no desires," and departed. With his passing, the only person who could definitively authorize changes to the Bhagavad Gita was gone. What remained were manuscripts, memories, recorded conversations, and disciples who genuinely believed they understood what their guru really wanted. The stage was set for the most successful literary substitution in modern spiritual history. Now we arrive at the heart of the labyrinth, where Maya's investigation encountered what can only be called the philosophical crime of the century. Understanding Prabhupada's obsessive devotion to his books made her next discovery not merely shocking but disorienting. Here was a man who personally reviewed every translation, approved every edition, corrected every error with the precision of a medieval monk illuminating manuscripts. His books were his legacy, exactly as he wanted them. Or so Maya had believed until the third Tuesday of her investigation. 3 weeks into what she had imagined would be a simple comparison, Maya encountered the alteration that would fundamentally reshape her understanding of how consciousness itself could be stolen through editorial sleight of hand. Purport to the verse 2.13, one she had memorized years earlier, repeated in daily meditation, carved into her spiritual memory as deeply as her own name. Editors had altered a single word, subtle enough that most readers passed over it without notice, yet significant enough to shift how one understands the human spiritual condition. One word changed, forgotten, replaced by forgetful, altering the doctrinal framework. The difference between tragedy and negligence, between being lost by circumstance and being careless by choice. Maya stared at the two books lying open before her like proof in a metaphysical murder case. This was not a typographical error. This was doctrinal revolution disguised as editorial improvement. That evening, needing to confirm what she hardly dared believe, Maya called a friend who specialized in spiritual counseling. "I'm going to read you two sentences," Maya said, her voice unsteady. "Tell me what each one makes you feel." She read both versions of the purport to verse 2.13, offering no context, no explanation. First, the original. "Under the circumstances, it is admitted that Lord Krishna is the Supreme Lord, superior in position to the living entity, Arjuna, who is a forgotten soul, deluded by Maya." Then the revision, "Under the circumstances, it is admitted that Lord Krishna is the Supreme Lord, superior in position to the living entity, Arjuna, who is a forgetful soul deluded by Maya." Her friend's response came without hesitation. "The first one makes me want to pray for help. The second makes me want to try harder." And there it was, the precise mechanism by which consciousness could be altered through a single word change. Maya now understood the doctrinal archaeology she was witnessing. The original word, forgotten, carried the weight of cosmic displacement, a soul lost by circumstances beyond its control, requiring divine intervention for recovery. The revision, forgetful, reduced this metaphysical tragedy to a character flaw, a temporary lapse in spiritual attention that better practice and stronger effort could correct. Grace versus effort. Mercy versus method. Mysticism versus methodology. The implications extended far beyond theoretical analysis. She had started investigating online forums where people discussed their spiritual struggles, and the correlation was unmistakable. Those reading the original 1972 edition wrote things like, "I feel so lost. Please pray for me. How can I surrender more completely? I need God's grace to transform me." Those reading the revised version wrote, "What meditation technique works best? How can I improve my focus during chanting? What study schedule will advance my practice?" The change had even affected her local temple. During Sunday classes, Maya noticed two distinct groups forming without anyone recognizing why. When verse 2.13 was discussed, Some people would nod knowingly about helplessness and the need for divine mercy. Others would suggest practical methods for improving attentiveness. Neither group could understand why the other seemed to miss the obvious point. The division wasn't about personality or maturity, it was about which edition they were reading. As she had found in her own experimentation, each version cultivated different responses: grace-seeking versus self-improvement consciousness. Most troubling was the discovery that this wasn't accidental. Through online research, she found references to Prabhupada's pre-publication materials examined by scholars in the Bhaktivedanta Book Trust archives. These early drafts consistently used "forgotten soul" rather than "forgetful soul." The 1972 Macmillan edition, which Prabhupada personally approved and used for teaching from 1972 until his death in 1977, maintained this choice. The 1972 published edition reflected his decision: "Who is a forgotten soul, deluded by Maya?" But in 1983, 6 years after his passing, editors made the change to "forgetful soul" without any authorization from Prabhupada himself. The weight of her discovery demanded consultation with someone who could explain the neurological mechanisms. Maya contacted Dr. Sarah Chen, a Stanford neuroscience professor whose research specialized in the neuroscience of religious consciousness, particularly how different types of devotional language create different modes of brain activity and, ultimately, distinct consciousness types. Maya had taken Chen's graduate seminar on contemplative neuroscience 2 years earlier during her doctoral coursework. Stanford's interdepartmental PhD program allowed religious studies students to take neuroscience courses, and Chen's seminar had been exactly the kind of cross-disciplinary work Maya's advisor encouraged. They had maintained a collegial relationship since, meeting occasionally to discuss the intersection of Maya's religious studies work with Chen's neurological research. Maya sat in Dr. Chen's office 2 days later, staring at brain scans that made her hands shake. Beauregard's fMRI studies of Carmelite nuns showed it: intimate devotional language, blessed Lord, forgotten soul, activated the limbic system, caudate nucleus, insula, the same regions that fire when a mother holds her infant, when lovers embrace, when friends experience deep trust, heart-centered, emotional, personal, but formal theological language, supreme personality of Godhead, forgetful soul, engaged prefrontal regions, abstract reasoning, systematic categorization, the same brain regions that activate during mathematics. Sarah, Maya said, struggling to articulate what seemed impossible. What would happen if someone secretly changed the Bible to say, workers who forget to pray instead of lost sheep? There would be riots, Chen replied. But more than that, you'd be changing the entire neurological foundation of how believers understand the human condition. Chen pulled out more studies: Meyer and Schwanevelt's psycholinguistics research, Mahmoud's anthropology from Egypt, educational psychology on authoritative versus intimate language, all pointing to the same conclusion: sacred names aren't labels, they're consciousness triggers. Repeated exposure to "Blessed Lord," Chen explained, pointing to the annotated studies spread across her desk, creates semantic priming, automatic activation of emotional networks. Love, trust, surrender. The brain literally expects grace. She flipped to another scan. But supreme personality of Godhead? That primes for hierarchy, authority, systematic understanding. The brain expects demands, not gifts. Maya thought of her grandmother in that hospital bed, confused by verses she'd memorized 40 years ago. Not because her memory had failed, because someone had altered what those verses meant at the deepest neurological level. Chen leaned back. You see it now? Blessed implies grace freely given, unearned favor. Forgotten soul means someone lost through no fault of their own, but supreme personality of Godhead demands proper theological understanding first. And forgetful soul? That's a character flaw requiring self-correction. They're not improving translation. They're programming different religious worlds. That meeting marked the moment Maya grasped the full scope of what had been accomplished. The changes from forgotten to forgetful, from blessed Lord to supreme personality of Godhead, these had not merely altered text. They had likely shaped millions of readers toward self-improvement consciousness rather than grace-seeking, potentially influencing their neural architecture for approaching the divine over time. She began tracking the real-world effects. Online spiritual forums showed the split. People reading the original sought prayer support and talked about surrendering to God's mercy. People reading the revision shared meditation techniques and discussed methodical spiritual advancement. Neither group knew. They thought they were having doctrinal disagreements. In reality, different editions had shaped them to understand spiritual life in fundamentally incompatible ways. Maya's investigation had revealed something shocking. This word change, one among hundreds of alterations, had contributed to secretly dividing an entire spiritual movement, helping create two incompatible approaches to spiritual life while everyone believed they were following the same path. As Maya's investigation deepened, she began to understand the broader implications. This wasn't just about one word and one verse. It represented a fundamental choice about human spiritual nature that echoed through all religious traditions. She found herself thinking about her grandmother, who used to say, "Pray for me, I'm lost without God's mercy." That was forgotten soul consciousness, humble recognition of spiritual helplessness. Compare that to the modern spiritual culture Maya saw everywhere. "I need to work on my spiritual practice, find better techniques, advance systematically." One evening, sitting with both editions open, Maya finally understood what had been done. Whoever made this change had quietly shifted millions of spiritual seekers from one approach to the other, from mystical dependence to methodical self-improvement, without their knowledge or consent. As Maya had discovered through her own testing, this single word change appeared to encourage two fundamentally different spiritual orientations: surrender consciousness versus improvement consciousness. This dichotomy existed throughout spiritual history. Some traditions emphasized human lostness requiring divine rescue. Others emphasized human capability requiring proper education. But here was the difference. In healthy spiritual traditions, people chose their approach consciously. They knew whether they were joining a mystical community seeking divine grace or an educational community pursuing methodical development. In the case of the Bhagavad Gita as it is, millions of people believed they shared a path. The editors had divided them invisibly, substituting choice with organizational mandate. Maya closed both books and leaned back in her chair. Her grandmother deserved answers. Real answers, not reassurances. The investigation that had begun with a single confusing verse was revealing something far larger: deliberate word changes that could reshape human consciousness on a global scale. She had documented what was changed. But the question that kept her awake wasn't what, it was how many. If they had altered this verse so systematically, what else had they transformed while the world wasn't watching? The arithmetic of deception reveals itself slowly, then all at once. What began as a simple comparison to reassure her grandmother became an obsession, the conviction that behind one altered verse lay an entire architecture of transformation. Maya Rodriguez now sat at her kitchen table surrounded by what had become the archaeology of a crime. Both editions of the Bhagavad Gita, colored sticky notes marking alterations like proof flags at a crime scene, notebooks filled with findings that no one would believe without seeing. Weeks had passed since that hospital conversation. Weeks during which friends at the temple had begun treating her questions about editorial improvements as symptoms of spiritual weakness. Weeks during which her own meditation practice fractured. How does one surrender to verses when one no longer knows which version contains authentic guidance? Her apartment had begun to resemble a detective's lair from crime procedurals, except instead of murder suspects on the wall, she had color-coded sticky notes marking doctrinal crimes. Her roommate, a PhD candidate in molecular biology who considered religious studies vaguely amusing, had taken to calling it the shrine to textual obsession. Maya couldn't argue with the diagnosis, but she could no longer stop. The evidence was undeniable. This was not random editing. This was systematic transformation accomplished through editorial precision that would have impressed the medieval forgers who created the Donation of Constantine. But analysis alone couldn't capture what these changes did to consciousness. Maya needed to experience it. For 2 weeks, she read chapter 2 from both versions during morning meditation, alternating days like a scientist testing variables on herself. With the original, she felt personally addressed, Krishna speaking directly to her heart across 5 millennia. With the revision, she felt like a graduate student receiving philosophical instruction from a distant professor. Same Sanskrit, different universe entirely. Dr. Chen had shown her the neurological research. Devotional language and analytical language create fundamentally different neural architectures. One book was creating mystics. The other was programming theologians. The transformation revealed itself through a single devastating example. In the original, verse 10.8 promised, "The wise who perfectly know this engage in my devotional service." The revision shifted one word. "The wise who know this perfectly engage in my devotional service." Perfectly know versus know perfectly. Grace versus achievement. Gift versus laboratory. 541 verses out of 700 had been altered throughout. Not improved. Transformed. Where Prabhupada had written Blessed Lord, intimate, personal, the revision demanded Supreme Personality of Godhead, 11 syllables of hierarchy. Where he had chosen steadfast in yoga, accessible to subway workers, they substituted equipoised, requiring philosophical credentials. Where Krishna declares, "I advent myself," 4.8, descending and becoming touchable, they made it, "I appear," maintaining abstract distance. Maya stared at the two books on her table, same title, same author. But one created mystics seeking divine love. The other created scholars pursuing systematic knowledge. For 4 decades, no institution informed readers they were choosing between fundamentally different sacred worlds. The question haunting her was no longer what had been done, but why, and whether sincere disciples could have transformed their guru's work without realizing they were stealing what he'd most carefully protected, the reader's heart connection to the divine, without realizing. That phrase struck Maya more than any other. If these changes truly oriented readers toward different types of consciousness, the effects should be visible, traceable, global. 22 years after the Great Substitution began, what Maya discovered across 5 continents revealed different mechanisms of deception, the same substitution manifesting with different symptoms, each exposing a different facet of the crime. The first symptom appeared in Russia. The Moscow incident provides the perfect case study in how linguistic conditioning creates organizational schism. The crisis erupted during a Sunday evening class at the Mandir Temple, when an elderly Russian devotee began reading from his treasured 1976 edition, one of the precious few books that had survived the Soviet Union's systematic religious oppression. As he quoted verse 7.12 about divine source, younger students began shaking their heads with the confidence of those who possess newer information. "That's not what it says, grandfather," one interrupted, producing her pristine 2003 edition. The elder's book. "I am not under the modes of material nature." Direct and simple. Her modern edition. "For they, on the contrary, are within me." A philosophical addendum. A total editorial whim. The room erupted in confusion. Sincere souls trying to understand the most fundamental question of existence, the nature of God's relationship to creation. Same verse number, same author's name. Completely different spiritual reality. Within months, the Moscow temple had effectively schismatized into 2 congregations, those committed to what they called the original transmission, and those trusting what they believed to be the improved version. Sunday classes became doctrinal battlegrounds where the very nature of divine reality was debated through conflicting quotations from books that claimed identical authority. What happened in Moscow was not isolated. As Maya examined international ISKCON communications, the same confusion had erupted independently across every continent. 5 different crises, each exposing a different mechanism of the same crime. In São Paulo, Brazil, the substitution weaponized translators. In 2008, a team producing a Portuguese edition faced an impossible choice. Which English version as source text? A professor of Sanskrit at the Universidade de São Paulo discovered the 2 English editions contained such fundamental doctrinal differences that the choice would determine the entire spiritual orientation of Portuguese-speaking practitioners for generations. "We are not translating words," she wrote to the Bhaktivedanta Book Trust. "We are choosing between 2 different metaphysical universes. Which consciousness do you want us to create for Portuguese speakers?" The BBT's response: "Use the revised edition as it represents the most current scholarship." The question of whose scholarship went unanswered. The translator privately confessed she felt like an accomplice in doctrinal colonization through editorial sleight of hand. London revealed retrospective victims. scholars who had built careers on citations that no longer existed. A King's College professor discovered the problem during a 2012 public lecture. He quoted from his 1975 edition, 3 decades of teaching. A student raised her hand. "Professor, that's not what my edition says." He experienced what he later called profound disorientation. The verses he had taught for 30 years had been rewritten. His entire published scholarship now contradicted current editions. He spent a year cataloging 127 discrepancies. He shared his findings with Maya, but declined to publish them. The professional cost would be too high, but I wanted someone to know. Iskhan's response. Silence. Then a letter suggesting he consult the most recent edition going forward. But the most chilling discovery came from Sydney. The substitution could divide communities without anyone noticing the text had changed. Invisible programming. At a temple in Sydney, Australia, something curious happened between 2005 and 2015. The community unconsciously divided into 2 groups that the temple president initially attributed to different levels of maturity. One group, predominantly older members who had joined in the 1970s and 80s, approached their practice through prayer, surrender, and seeking divine grace. They spoke of feeling lost without Krishna's mercy and emphasized the soul's helplessness in material existence. The other group, mostly younger practitioners who had joined after 2000, approached their practice through systematic study, disciplined meditation schedules, and measurable advancement. They spoke of improving their focus and developing better habits. It was a doctoral student in religious studies, observing the community for his research, who noticed the correlation. The 2 groups were reading different editions of the Bhagavad Gita. The older practitioners, many still using their original books from the 1970s, had been shaped by text that emphasized forgotten soul and divine relationship. The younger practitioners, reading recently purchased editions, had been shaped by text that emphasized forgetful soul and self-improvement. Same tradition, same temple, same deity on the altar. But 2 completely different approaches to devotional life, divided not by philosophy or teaching, but by editorial choices made decades earlier by people thousands of miles away who had never consulted the communities their changes would affect. When the temple president discovered this correlation, she described her reaction in the temple's monthly newsletter. "I realized we weren't experiencing diversity. We were experiencing textual manipulation. India, the homeland of the Bhagavad Gita itself, rejected the revision as Western colonial imposition." In 2015, a University of Mumbai Sanskrit professor was asked to verify some translations. What began as casual consultation became an investigation that shocked India's traditional scholarly community. He found instances where the revised edition contradicted not only Prabhupada's original, but the Sanskrit source itself. Changes reflecting Western editorial preference rather than Vedic textual transmission. "We have maintained these texts for 5,000 years, the professor wrote in an analysis shared privately with Maya. "These changes are not translations. They impose Western philosophical categories onto Vedic revelation." Indian ISKCON scholars, steeped in traditional textual transmission, understood immediately what their Western counterparts had missed. That systematic textual alteration without transparent records violates how sacred knowledge is supposed to be preserved. Maya finally understood what connected them. Moscow showed the human cost, divided communities. Brazil showed the mechanism of spread, translators forced into complicity. London showed the erasure of history, scholarship invalidated retroactively. Sydney showed the invisibility, unconscious division. Mumbai showed cultural betrayal, the homeland itself rejecting Western editorial colonization. The pattern was mathematically consistent worldwide. Temple divisions, citation inconsistencies, paralyzed translation committees, Sanskrit scholars questioning fidelity, devotees experiencing spiritual whiplash. The response was uniformly identical across all continents. Absolute silence about the scope of changes, combined with dismissal of concerned readers as lacking sufficient faith. 5 continents. 5 communities discovering the same wound. But 1 question remained. How had they concealed such widespread transformation for 4 decades? The BBT website contained no announcement, no press release, no explanation. Maya had spent 2 hours searching for any official acknowledgement of the changes she'd so meticulously cataloged. The silence was absolute. and that silence, she was beginning to realize, was the entire strategy. How do you hide the systematic transformation of a sacred text from millions of readers across six continents? The answer she discovered was both simpler and more chilling than any elaborate conspiracy theory. The perfect crime requires no sophisticated misdirection, only perfect silence. For 40 years, the transformation of the Bhagavad Gita succeeded through a strategy so elegant it would have impressed Machiavelli. Never acknowledge what happened. Never admit scope. Never provide comparison. Never allow memory to solidify around the magnitude of change. This amnesia revealed itself when she attempted to locate official explanations for the differences she had so meticulously cataloged. The Bhaktivedanta Book Trust website contained no announcement of systematic revision, no press release, no scholarly explanation. Years later, facing mounting questions from around the world, they would release a few defensive videos. But in the decades following 1983, institutions maintained only silence. Library catalog systems showed no distinction between radically different editions. Bookstore staff possessed no knowledge of what they were selling. The silence was not accidental. It was organizational policy, refined over decades into an art form. Maya's archaeological excavation of this policy revealed a three-pronged strategy that emerged in the 1980s with mathematical precision. Prong 1. Never announce changes. Let revised and enlarged editions speak for themselves. Prevent confusion among readers satisfied with their current spiritual understanding. Prong 2. When questioned directly about differences, emphasize scholarly improvements rather than acknowledge doctrinal alterations. Rely on the reasonable assumption that most readers lack sufficient time or expertise to investigate deeply enough to become genuinely concerned. Prong 3. If pressed further, redirect attention from textual concerns to spiritual practice. Position comparison itself as materialistic distraction from authentic devotional focus. The strategy worked with breathtaking effectiveness. For two decades, most readers remained completely unaware of the substitution. Libraries systematically replaced old editions with new ones. Temples distributed whatever versions were currently available from publishers. But the strategy contained a fatal flaw that would eventually bring down the entire edifice. It could not survive systematic comparison by someone with both time and determination. When Maya contacted the Moscow temple about their congregational schism, the temple president's response revealed the playbook in action. "We don't encourage comparisons between editions. Such material concerns distract from spiritual focus. Our policy is to use whatever books are currently available and trust that Krishna will guide sincere readers to appropriate understanding." This strategy was implemented in book distribution too. Maya found identical responses from institutions across six continents. The uniformity was so consistent it suggested either remarkable coincidence or coordinated policy. Acknowledge no wrongdoing, minimize the significance of alterations, redirect attention from textual analysis to devotional practice. Even the external pressures that had initiated the revision process later generated organizational regret. Some academics whose criticism had initially pressured the BBT toward systematic revision later expressed profound remorse about unintended consequences. They never imagined that pointing out legitimate translation errors would lead to wholesale rewriting without public disclosure. Their criticism was intended to improve scholarly accuracy, not enable four decades of textual deception. The cover-up succeeded because it exploited the most fundamental assumption readers make about published texts. That books bearing identical titles and author attributions contain essentially identical content. Publishers, libraries, and spiritual institutions all benefited from this assumption because it avoided complicated explanations and potentially devastating controversies. Perhaps most tellingly, even sympathetic insiders struggled with the moral implications of what had been accomplished. A former BBT employee who insisted on anonymity provided the most chilling insight. By the 1990s, everyone involved realized the scope of changes was exponentially larger than initially intended. But how do you publicly admit to over a decade of hidden alterations without destroying all credibility? The strategy evolved from confidence into damage control rather than transparency. The cover-up had become its own self-perpetuating system, feeding on the very silence that had made it possible. The internet age changed everything. websites began cataloging specific changes. Forums emerged where confused readers shared discoveries. What had been isolated incidents of individual confusion became networked proof of systematic deception. In 2005, the BookChanges.com project began systematic archiving. By 2010, online databases contained hundreds of side-by-side comparisons. The proof became impossible to ignore or suppress. The response evolved, but maintained the core strategy. Acknowledge minimal changes, while denying systematic alteration. Recent official statements admit to editorial improvements and restorations, while insisting that the content remains essentially unchanged. But Maya's investigation had revealed the truth. The scope of alterations was comprehensive and systematic. This wasn't editorial improvement. It was textual transformation hidden behind silence. The cover-up had lasted 40 years because it served everyone's immediate interests. Publishers avoided admitting deception, institutions avoided acknowledging error, readers avoided confronting uncomfortable truths about spiritual authority. But, as Maya was discovering, the cost of this silence extended far beyond publishing ethics. It had fractured communities, confused sincere seekers, and created a crisis of trust that threatened the very transmission the original book was meant to preserve. And the fractures ran deeper than she'd imagined, right through the heart of the movement itself. Maya's most important discovery, proof, recorded, time-stamped, undeniable, that Prabhupada had explicitly approved translations later changed without his authorization. The specificity of this evidence was what shook her. These weren't interpretive debates about Prabhupada's intentions. These were documented approvals systematically altered after his death. Combing through the Vedabase archives, thousands of hours of Prabhupada's recorded classes, Maya found smoking gun proof. In a class from December 16, 1968, someone had read verse 2.48 aloud to Prabhupada. Be steadfast in yoga, O Arjuna. Perform your duty and abandon all attachment to success or failure. Such evenness of mind is called yoga. Prabhupada's immediate response. This is the explanation of yoga, evenness of mind, yoga samatvam uchyat. If you work for Krishna, then there is no cause of lamentation or jubilation. He had emphasized the exact concepts, steadfast in yoga and evenness of mind, that appeared in the published translation. Explicit approval. The 1983 revised edition. Perform your duty equipoised, O Arjuna, abandoning all attachment to success or failure. Such equanimity is called yoga. Editors had deleted steadfast in yoga and replaced evenness of mind with equanimity. The very concepts Prabhupada had highlighted, systematically removed by people who believed they knew better than the author. This wasn't isolated. She discovered disturbing consistency across multiple verses, each recorded approval followed by posthumous alteration. A 1974 class transcript of verse 6.31 showed Prabhupada's response emphasizing personal relationship. Worships me, this is bhakti yoga, not impersonal meditation, direct worship of Krishna. Despite this explicit emphasis on worships me, the revision redirected it to worshipful service of the supersoul, shifting focus from the personal God to an impersonal aspect. This continued across dozens of verses. In verse 2.30, Prabhupada emphasized eternal four times, yet editors deleted that word. In verse 3.32, he quoted, "Do not practice them regularly, verbatim in classes." The revision changed practice to follow. Each discovery revealed systematic erasure. Words Prabhupada had explicitly approved, removed by editors who believed they knew better. Maya found Prabhupada's prophetic warning in a 1972 letter. A little learning is dangerous, especially for the Westerners. I am practically seeing that, as soon as they begin to learn a little Sanskrit, immediately they feel that they have become more than their guru, and then the policy is kill guru and be killed himself. The revised edition's own introduction confirmed it. The Sanskrit editors were by now accomplished scholars, able to see their way through perplexities in the manuscript. They had become, as he warned, more qualified than their guru, in their own estimation. The proof established beyond reasonable doubt. Prabhupada had heard original translations read aloud, explicitly approved them, emphasized concepts later deleted, used the published text for teaching until his death in 1977, and never requested the systematic alterations later implemented. No record existed of him authorizing anyone to revise and enlarge his completed work. The conclusion was inescapable. Comprehensive unauthorized alteration had occurred. But unauthorized changes to approved translations was only part of Maya's discovery. She found something more disturbing, systematic editorial invention beyond claiming to restore Prabhupada's intent. In verse 2.18, the purport emphasis shifted dramatically. The 1972 purport: Arjuna was advised to fight and to sacrifice the material body for the cause of religion. The 1983 purport: Arjuna was advised to fight and not sacrifice the cause of religion for material bodily considerations. Opposite psychological effects. One said, be willing to die for truth. The other said, don't compromise truth to avoid death. Similar territory, fundamentally different emphasis. Then verse 4.11. The class transcript from January 8, 1969 showed Prabhupada explicitly quoting. So the original verse says that, all of them, as they surrender unto me, I reward accordingly. He had called it the original verse, quoted it with approval. The revisers changed it anyway. As all surrender unto me, I reward them accordingly. Her research revealed, the BBT created alternatives appearing in neither draft manuscripts nor published originals, changes implemented even when Prabhupada had explicitly approved the original in recorded classes. Doctrinal meanings shifted consistently toward technical precision and away from devotional accessibility. No documentation existed of Prabhupada requesting these alterations. Maya's conclusion: these weren't two editions of the same book. They were two different books wearing the same title. Original readers encountered devotional intimacy, an invitation to personal relationship. Revised readers encountered formal hierarchy, a demand for doctrinal precision. Original readers learned they were forgotten souls requiring divine grace. Revised readers learned they were forgetful souls who needed to try harder. Original readers were taught to be steadfast in yoga with evenness of mind. Revised readers were instructed to be equipoised with equanimity, technically similar, emotionally miles apart. The timeline made editorial authorization impossible to defend. 1972 to 1977. Prabhupada used the published edition for daily teaching without requesting alterations. 1977. Prabhupada passed away, never having authorized systematic revision. 1983. BBT published comprehensive revision based on their own Sanskrit studies. Decades later, audio evidence proved Prabhupada had explicitly approved what was later changed. The evidence made one question unavoidable. When you read the Bhagavad Gita as it is, do you want Prabhupada's approved translations that he taught from for 5 years? Or committee improvements implemented against his documented wishes by editors who believed their Sanskrit studies made them more qualified than their guru? The smoking gun evidence, preserved in audio recordings, transcribed by devotees, now impossible to suppress in the internet age, made this choice unavoidable. The house had been divided, not by those who raised questions, but by those who made the changes and tried to hide them. She had documented what was changed. Now she needed to understand what was lost. The alteration in the divine voice, the one that had driven Maya's investigation since that hospital conversation with her grandmother, could finally be named. 22 times. Every single moment Krishna speaks in the Bhagavad Gita, every single instance, not editing, systematic reprogramming of how readers encounter divinity itself. Every divine utterance in the Bhagavad Gita has been systematically altered. Original, intimate divine address as Blessed Lord. Revised, formal hierarchical title as Supreme Personality of Godhead. This affects every moment the reader encounters divine speech throughout the text. 22 times, the reader's neurological response to the divine has been redirected from intimacy to hierarchy, from grace expectation to authority recognition. As Dr. Chen had shown Maya with the brain scans and neuroscience studies, these weren't stylistic preferences. They were consciousness-shaping choices that would create fundamentally different types of spiritual practitioners. Same Sanskrit, same English, two completely different gods. The original, divine character, gracious, approachable, personally caring. Reader positioned as beloved, invited into intimacy. Transformation through grace and heart opening. The revision, divine character, authoritative, systematic, theologically precise. Reader positioned as student, systematic practitioner. Transformation through knowledge and proper understanding. This wasn't stylistic preference. This was the fundamental question of how humans connect with the divine, answered two completely opposite ways in books bearing identical titles. These different approaches create different types of human development. Original Edition, Heart-Centered Mysticism. Intimate Prayer Life with Personal Divine Relationship. Heart-Centered Practice, emphasizing love and surrender. Direct Approaches to Divine Reality through Devotional Methods. Mystical Orientation, seeking union with beloved divine person. Grace-dependent transformation, expecting divine intervention. Revised Edition, Mind-Centered Systematization. Systematic practice, emphasizing proper understanding. Mind-centered approaches through doctrinal study and application. Institutional orientation, seeking guidance through proper authorities. Religious development through systematic principle application. Knowledge-dependent transformation through religious education. This transformation reflects broader tensions between mystical and institutional approaches to spirituality. The mystical path offers direct divine relationship, personal transformation through love, immediate access to the divine through sincere heart approach. The institutional path requires methodical development, proper doctrinal understanding, mediated access through hierarchical authority. Both approaches serve legitimate needs, but they create different types of religious culture and different kinds of human beings. The tragedy isn't that systematic doctrinal approaches exist, it's that readers don't know they're receiving systematic teaching when they expect mystical devotion. The book's cover bears Prabhupada's name. The theology inside often contradicts his documented preferences. These changes affect actual spiritual practice. Original, Blessed Lord, please help me understand. Intimate appeal. Revised effect. Supreme Personality of Godhead, I acknowledge your authority. Formal submission. Original, Turn to gracious beloved who cares personally. Revised effect. Turn to ultimate authority who requires proper understanding. Original, Beloved friend accompanies through life's challenges. Revised effect. Ultimate authority oversees systematic spiritual development. When confronted with this evidence, institutional defenders employ predictable responses. Both names refer to the same person, ignoring neurological and emotional impact. The formal title is more accurate, prioritizing technical precision over spiritual effectiveness. Devotees understand the difference, missing the point about neural conditioning. These defenses miss the fundamental issue. Different names create different relationships, which create different human beings. This systematic alteration of divine names represents the broader trend documented throughout the revision, institutional systematic approaches replacing mystical devotional methods. The question each reader must answer, do you want intimate relationship with divine blessing or systematic understanding of theological hierarchy? Both are legitimate spiritual approaches. But you deserve to know which one you're getting. The solution isn't eliminating systematic approaches, but preserving choice. Readers seeking mystical devotion deserve access to the original intimate address. Readers preferring systematic theology can choose the formal theological version. What they don't deserve is systematic theology disguised as mystical devotion or institutional revision presented as authentic transmission. The divine reality transcends all names and forms. But human consciousness develops through specific linguistic and emotional triggers. When those triggers are deliberately altered, the result is spiritual deception rather than authentic choice. God remains who God is. But how readers approach and experience divine reality depends entirely on the type of spiritual training they receive. These alterations transform the reader's spiritual trajectory entirely, which raised the question Maya couldn't escape. If words shape souls this profoundly, who gets to choose which words millions of seekers will read? Beyond the major alterations lay something subtler, more devastating. Maya began collecting translation pairs, side-by-side examples revealing the transformation with crystalline clarity. The bewildered soul versus the confused living entity. The first suggested someone emotionally lost, requiring divine grace. The second described a cognitive problem requiring better information. Verse 10.10 revealed the pattern again. The original read, "Worship me with love," implying romance, intimacy, God reaching down to meet the devotee. The revision changed it to "serving me with love," suggesting employment, systematic devotion, proper religious relationship maintained through duty rather than desire. Maya's spreadsheet grew to hundreds of examples. Her independent analysis revealed that only 29% improved English quality, yet 100% consistently reduced emotional accessibility. The personal cost became clear during her own meditation experiments. Heart language embedded itself naturally in consciousness. Blessed Lord, arising spontaneously during moments of stress or need. The formal title required conscious effort, felt artificial in prayer. It was like addressing your beloved as distinguished individual of romantic significance. The neuroscience wasn't theory anymore. It was happening in her own spiritual life. She began observing how linguistic differences created different spiritual cultures within the same tradition, conducting what amounted to an informal ethnographic survey through phone interviews and temple visits across North America. The Midwest temples, where practitioners still treasured their original 1970s editions, had developed intimate fellowships and shared devotional experiences. Maya visited a Sunday feast at a temple in Ohio, where the temple president, a former factory worker, told stories about Krishna with an ease that came from feeling rather than studying, encouraging emotional sharing and creating spaces for what he called heart opening. Their stated spiritual goals centered on divine love, personal relationship, mystical union with the beloved. When members faced crisis, and Maya heard about plenty, divorce, illness, financial collapse, the community responded with emotional support, prayer fellowship, and collective grace seeking. These temples felt like extended families, gatherings where you could admit you had no idea what you were doing spiritually, but desperately wanted to feel closer to God. The coastal academic communities, where revised editions dominated the bookshelves, had developed educational fellowships and systematic study groups. Maya attended a Thursday evening class at an East Coast temple where the discussion leader, a PhD candidate in religious studies, led analytical discussions about the philosophical implications of various Sanskrit terms, emphasizing concept mastery with PowerPoint presentations and handouts. Their stated spiritual goals centered on proper understanding, systematic advancement, knowledge attainment. When members faced crisis, the community responded with counseling resources, study intensification, and technique application. One member told Maya she'd been assigned 3 additional chapters to study when she expressed depression. These temples felt like spiritual academies, gatherings where intellectual precision was valued over emotional vulnerability and you were expected to articulate your spiritual struggles in properly doctrinal language. Maya attended Sunday morning kirtan at the Ohio temple. The harmonium began, simple, repetitive melody, voices joining one by one. Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hari Hari. The factory worker president swayed slightly, eyes half closed, hands moving through the air as if conducting something invisible. Around him, maybe 30 people, construction workers in jeans, older women in saris, college students, a family with restless children, chanted with varying degrees of enthusiasm and tune. No particular grace to it, just sound, bodies moving, the smell of incense mixing with the potluck dal someone was heating in the kitchen. Something unpretentious and oddly comforting. That evening at the East Coast Temple, she sat through a 90-minute lecture on verse 7.4's philosophical implications. The PhD candidate had prepared slides, very precise, very systematic, and organized with the kind of care one applies to concepts rather than relationships. Neither approach was wrong. The question was, which approach serves spiritual seekers more effectively? Or rather, because Maya had learned to distrust simple either-or questions, which approach serves which seekers under which circumstances? Dr. Chen had laid out the cost-benefit analysis with characteristic academic detachment during one of their coffee meetings at the Stanford faculty lounge, using sugar packets to represent competing values on the table between them. Heart language, Chen explained while arranging 3 sugar packets in a row, offered immediate emotional accessibility for practitioners at all educational levels. A construction worker could experience the same divine intimacy as a philosophy professor. It created natural devotional response and spiritual longing without requiring theological training. The verses became memorable, capable of producing transformative spiritual experiences that people carried for decades. Most importantly, it developed intuitive spiritual understanding through heart connection, the kind of knowledge that couldn't be taught, but only experienced. Mind language, Chen continued while creating a separate row of sugar packets, satisfied intellectual requirements for systematic understanding, crucial for academic respectability and theological precision. It created proper frameworks for systematic spiritual development, producing presentations that could stand scrutiny in university religious studies departments. It developed analytical spiritual comprehension through systematic study, the kind of knowledge that could be tested, measured, and transmitted through conventional educational methods. Maya had stared at the two rows of sugar packets, understanding for the first time that this wasn't about one approach being wrong. It was about what you needed from a spiritual text, and whether you got what you expected when you opened a book that claimed to be as it is. Maya's late-night research sessions had acquired a rhythm. Herbal tea cooling forgotten on her desk, yellow highlighter bleeding through pages of religious history, the discovery that what she had thought was unique to Krishna consciousness was actually a phenomenon as old as organized religion itself. It was 2:47 a.m. when she stumbled upon the parallel in Christian mysticism. St. John of the Cross, 16th century Spanish monk, imprisoned by his own order for 9 months in a cell barely large enough to stand, had written of the dark night of the soul in language so intimate, so devastatingly personal, that Maya found herself weeping while reading his poetry. This was heart language, raw, vulnerable, desperate for divine touch. Then she turned to Thomas Aquinas. Same century, same Catholic tradition, utterly different universe. The prime mover, the first cause, pure act, concepts so abstract they required 3 years of philosophical training just to discuss properly. Mind language, systematic, precise, magnificent in its intellectual architecture, but about as emotionally accessible as a doctoral dissertation on quantum mechanics. Teresa of Avila spoke of the soul as an interior castle with 7 rooms, where God waited as a lover for the mystical marriage of divine union. Her metaphors were wedding chambers and passionate embraces. Meanwhile, systematic theology cataloged God through ontological arguments and philosophical categories, perfect for seminaries, devastating for seekers wanting to know how to experience the divine they were supposedly analyzing. Maya began creating what she called her transformation map, covering an entire wall of her apartment with sticky notes connecting similar transformations across religious traditions. The consistency was so striking, it felt like uncovering a law of spiritual physics. Mystical founders speak in heart language to gather followers. Institutional administrators translate into mind language to control them. Not maliciously, usually sincerely believing they were improving, or clarifying, or making more precise, the founder's messy emotional outbursts. She found the same trajectory in Islamic mysticism, Rumi's ecstatic poetry about divine wine and spinning dancers systematically reinterpreted by legal scholars into proper jurisprudential frameworks. In Buddhism, the Buddha's practical advice about suffering gradually transformed into elaborate metaphysical systems requiring scholarly expertise to navigate. The Bhagavad Gita revision, Maya realized with that unsettling recognition that accompanies discovering you're not experiencing something unique but rather something universal, represented exactly this movement from mystical toward scholastic language, a shift so extensively documented in comparative religious studies that scholars had created entire academic careers analyzing what happens when spiritual movements transition from charismatic founders to institutional administrators. Research on sacred text transmission, including Wendy Doniger's comparative analysis in The Implied Spider, Politics and Theology in Myth, Columbia University Press, 1998, a book Maya had found simultaneously brilliant and infuriating for its tendency to make 3 tangential observations for every direct argument, revealed a recurring dynamic Maya began to recognize across religious traditions. Institutional revisions often move from personal, emotionally accessible language, what Maya thought of as charismatic language, toward formal, systematic language requiring institutional mediation, bureaucratic language. This seemed to reflect not conscious conspiracy, but unconscious institutional psychology. Organizations instinctively converting founders' language into institutional language to gain academic legitimacy and administrative control, usually while sincerely believing they were improving or correcting the original. Historical studies document that posthumous textual modifications, whether in early Christian gospels, Islamic hadith collections, or Hindu scriptural commentaries, typically serve institutional rather than spiritual needs, though the institutions themselves rarely recognize this distinction. Maya understood, reluctantly at first, and then with growing certainty, that both linguistic approaches served legitimate spiritual needs. The question wasn't which was better in some absolute sense. It was recognizing that they created fundamentally different types of human spiritual development. The heart language readers, those encountering intimate divine names and grace-dependent teachings, naturally sought emotional spiritual connection and devotional transformation. They responded to personal divine relationship, understood themselves as grace-dependent, developed through love-centered practices, and surrender consciousness. They created temple communities that felt like extended families gathered around a beloved friend who happened to be God. The mind language readers, those encountering formal theological titles and self-improvement teachings, naturally sought systematic spiritual understanding and educational development. They responded to proper theological instruction, understood themselves as knowledge-dependent, developed through study-centered practices and systematic advancement. They created temple communities that felt like spiritual universities, with rigorous curriculum and measurable progress. Maya had witnessed both types in her own temple, never understanding why some people were drawn to prayer, while others were drawn to philosophical discourse, why some sought comfort in devotional songs, while others sought clarity in textual analysis. She had attributed it to personality differences or levels of spiritual maturity. Now, she understood. They were reading different books. Not different editions of the same book. Different spiritual universes presented under identical titles. The issue wasn't that both approaches existed. The issue was that readers received mind language when they expected heart language, systematic theology when they sought mystical devotion, and were never told that a choice had been made on their behalf. Maya stood at her wall covered in sticky notes, tracing connections between St. John of the Cross and the Ohio Temple president, between Aquinas and the East Coast PhD candidate. The evidence was undeniable. Someone purchasing Prabhupada's Bhagavad Gita as it is, expected Prabhupada's heart-centered linguistic approach. What they received was committee mind language posing as authentic transmission. She pulled down a sticky note and wrote in the margin of her notebook, "When you systematically alter sacred language without disclosure, you don't just change words. You steal the reader's access to the type of spiritual transformation the original offered. Both approaches deserve preservation. Both deserve honest identification. Neither deserves to masquerade as the other." Her grandmother's confusion suddenly made perfect sense. You can't read heart language for 50 years and then one day pick up mind language under the same title without experiencing profound disorientation. The theft wasn't just textual, it was spiritual. But Maya still didn't know who had authorized it, or how they'd justified transforming a sacred text without telling millions of readers. David Matthews stirred his chai thoughtfully. "I was young and idealistic," the former BBT devotee began. "We all believed we were preserving Prabhupada's books for future generations. I didn't realize until 1985 that preservation had become transformation." Maya had tracked him down, a former devotee who had worked at the BBT and resigned after discovering the scope of the changes. They sat in a California cafe, her notebook ready. "How could a sacred text be thoroughly transformed without anyone noticing?" Maya asked. "Good intentions," David sighed. "Let me explain how the publishing process worked. First under Prabhupada, then after." In 1972, the process was beautifully simple. Prabhupada would dictate, his secretary would type, he would personally review everything. David described what he called transmission integrity, a direct path from the author's spiritual realization to the reader's heart. Prabhupada wrote his manuscript with clear spiritual intention, publishers performed basic editing for typographical accuracy, and the book reached readers maintaining his exact vision. Minimal filtration, maximum authenticity. "He was involved in every decision," David continued. The documented record proved it. Prabhupada wrote translations with specific spiritual intentions, made final decisions on disputed points, approved the finished product, and used the published edition for his lectures from 1972 to 1977. He carried that 1972 edition everywhere. It was his authorized version, the one he quoted from memory in hundreds of lectures. Everything changed when Prabhupada passed away. Within 6 months, we had editorial committees, review boards, Sanskrit consultants. Everyone suddenly knew better what Prabhupada really meant. What was the justification? Improvement. Making the books more academically respectable, more precise. The BBT began extensive revisions in 1978. After Prabhupada's departure, fundamental dynamics shifted. The living author who could explain intentions was gone. Institutional authority emerged, claiming to preserve and improve his work. Multiple voices claimed to represent the author's true intent. Academic pressures arose that Prabhupada had never faced. The irony is that Prabhupada specifically rejected purely academic approaches. He insisted translators must be not only scholar, but a realized soul. He said, "Simply scholars will not help. Simply scholarship will not help." The committee structure was like a game of telephone with sacred texts. Editorial teams changed intimate language to theological terminology. Sanskrit consultants corrected Prabhupada's interpretations based on academic standards, missing the devotional mood. The GBC wanted academic respectability. Each group genuinely believed they were helping. So each layer added their own agenda, Maya said. Exactly. The tragedy is that the one voice missing from every meeting was Prabhupada's. Committees couldn't know his intentions. They emerged from spiritual realization, not academic training. When I left the BBT, I tried to make sense of all the changes. They fell into three categories, David said. First, minor corrections. Spelling, punctuation, obvious errors that everyone agrees needed fixing. Second, thousands of style changes disguised as improvements. Subjective preferences masquerading as enhancement. Third, and most disturbing, systematic theological revisions. Unauthorized transformation of meaning. The problem is, they mixed all three categories together and called them all corrections. How did readers not notice? Maya asked. His answer was chilling in its simplicity. We made sure they couldn't. He outlined the three-part deception. False continuity. Same title, same author's name. Why would anyone suspect the inside had changed? The improvement narrative. When questioned, we'd emphasize the typo fixes and downplay the theological changes. Just making it more accurate to the Sanskrit, we'd say. Maintaining reader ignorance. Here's the worst part. We actively removed the original from circulation. No comparison possible. We even told distributors the original had errors and should be destroyed. Maya felt sick. That's not preservation. That's replacement. How did you justify this to yourselves? He rubbed his face. Three rationalizations I now recognize as self-deception. First, we told ourselves we were Prabhupada's representatives. Therefore, our decisions were his decisions. Second, we focused on genuine improvements and ignored theological changes. We're making it better, became our mantra. Third, everyone believed comprehensive revision was superior. When everyone agrees, who questions? When did you realize what you'd done? When I read both versions side by side in 1985. I quit the next day. Here's what haunts me. Readers of the original received conscious choice, accurate understanding, access to authentic transmission, informed consent. Readers of our revision got unconscious selection, false assumptions, committee theology disguised as authentic transmission, imposed trajectories without their awareness. This process reveals how institutional publishing transforms sacred content. 1. Groups make decisions no individual would make. 2. Small alterations accumulate into extensive transformation. 3. Good intentions don't guarantee spiritual integrity. 4. Language skills can't substitute for inner realization. 5. People receive altered content unknowingly. Maya wrestled with questions that kept her awake. Do readers have the right to know when sacred content has been altered? Should institutional needs ever override preservation? Could technical improvements justify theological revision? What consent is required when modifying sacred texts that shape millions of lives? So what's the solution, transparency and preservation. The original must remain intact and available. Anyone can create new editions, but they must be clearly differentiated. David's framework, edition. Naming. Bhagavad Gita, as it is, 1972 original, versus 1983 revised, versus 2025 student edition. Clear attribution. Original translation by A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami versus revised by BBT Editorial Board. Purpose statements. Each edition explains its intended audience. The change documentation. Appendix listing major alterations. Parallel availability. Bookstores stock multiple versions. The original remains the root text. Everything else is clearly marked as derivative work. Without clear principles protecting spiritual integrity, each generation justifies further alterations. This is how authentic transmission disappears, through incremental improvement by well-intentioned committees. Can this be fixed, after 40 years? He smiled for the first time. Absolutely. The internet changed everything. People can compare versions now. The truth is out. David leaned forward. There's a recovery path, but it requires something rare in religious institutions: humility. First, acknowledgement. The BBT must publicly acknowledge the scope of changes. No more minimizing, no more calling it minor improvements. Second, restoration. Ensure the 1972 original remains accessible and in print. Let people choose which version speaks to their heart. Third, transparency. Label everything clearly. Original versus revised. Prabhupada's words versus committee edits. Fourth, education. Help readers understand the differences, not to create division but to enable informed choice. And finally, the hardest step, institutional accountability. You're stewards, not owners, David said quietly. The original must stay intact, always. The most disturbing aspect wasn't malicious intention. Everyone meant well. It was deception through institutional processes that transformed sacred content while maintaining the appearance of authentic transmission. Readers had a right to know they were receiving posthumous editorial theology, not Prabhupada's approved work. The deception ends when the choice becomes conscious. As Maya left, she knew her next step, confronting the defenders of the revision. At 3:17 in the morning, an email arrived that Maya had not expected to receive. Her desk was surrounded by 17 books open to various pages, conversation circles, she called them. Tonight, Prabhupada's 1972 Bhagavad Gita, spine cracked, pages annotated, the 1983 revision, borrowed, pristine, 3 volumes of Sanskrit commentary, 2 books on translation theory, and a volume of Borges essays, as if his labyrinths might provide relief from the tangle she had discovered in sacred transmission. The email's sender, Devananda Swami. 50 years in the tradition, a prominent ISKCON guru, author of 12 books, thousands of initiated disciples across 4 continents. He had studied in Vrindavan, taught in Mayapur, established temples in Europe and America, and served for decades in senior BBT editorial positions. His photograph showed a man whose face had settled into that expression of serene authority that comes from decades of never being contradicted. The email itself was brief. Ms. Rodriguez, I have heard of your investigation into textual differences between editions of the Bhagavad Gita as it is. I am attaching an audio message addressing this matter. If you wish to continue this discussion, I will consider your response. Devananda Swami. The attachment, a single audio file on an institutional server, secure, password protected, traceable. The audio itself proved interesting. Devananda Swami had recorded his response rather than writing it, revealing. Audio permits rhetorical moves, text does not. The strategic pause, the sigh of exasperation, the elevation of voice suggesting patience tried. It also resists close analysis. One cannot underline a sigh, one cannot footnote a pause. Maya downloaded the file, opened her audio editing software, to annotate, timestamp, create a critical edition of spoken words, and listened. Good morning. His voice, measured, accented with what Maya recognized as upper caste North Indian English, the kind that signals education at institutions where Sanskrit and philosophy were taught alongside cricket and colonial administration. I find this topic to be one that has been discussed millions of times. Here a slight laugh, not quite derisive but not quite generous either, and exhausted. I am very familiar with the accusation that two versions lead to different paths. Pause. 3 seconds. The sound of papers shuffling. Which is absurd, not to mention... Another pause, shorter. Stupid. Maya rewound. Listened again. The progression from absurd to stupid was interesting. Escalation disguised as clarification. She made a note. It seems to me that the people who talk like this have their own selfish personal motives. The phrase delivered with precise diction, in contexts where it effectively ended discussion. I worked for many years in the BBT. Prabhupada trusted me to produce his books. Appeal to authority, Maya noted. If you can give me a practical, solid example of a change that shows the two versions lead to different spiritual paths, really? Give me a practical example, and if it has merit, I'll accept it. The sentence ended with finality that did not actually invite response. The master permitting a student to demonstrate competence, knowing the demonstration will fail. Maya responded with 3 documented examples, each chosen for its clarity. 1. The transformation of forgotten soul to forgetful soul in Bhagavad Gita 2.13, shifting spiritual tragedy from divine to human responsibility. 2. The systematic replacement of the Blessed Lord said with the Supreme Personality of Godhead said in 22 instances, reframing the divine relationship from blessing bestower to ontological superior. 3. The alteration of all surrender to them surrender in 4.11, transforming universal reciprocation into conditional response. The Swami's response came as another audio file, this time defensive. These things are so honestly childish. Intimate names versus formal titles? Different tone, yes. But not a philosophical transformation. I oppose the changes, but to exaggerate that it changes everything. Please, that's not for adults. The strategy was clear. Acknowledge the difference. Minimize its significance. Dismiss examination as exaggeration. Maya recognized it as the standard institutional defense, not denial of facts, but compartmentalization. Yes, changes exist. No, they don't matter. Yes, they're wrong. No, examining them closely is immature. She sought a second opinion from Dr. Ramanuja Shastri, a former ISKCON scholar teaching in Kerala. His response cut through the Swami's rhetorical moves. The Swami claims intimate names and formal titles are functionally equivalent. This assumes denotation exhausts meaning. But words aren't merely pointers. They're consciousness-shaping tools. Intimate address belongs to gift-giving, grace freely given. Formal titles belong to systematic theology. They invite analysis, not approach. On forgotten versus forgetful, the Swami argues from theological logic, Krishna never forgets, therefore souls are forgetful. But Prabhupada wrote from the conditioned soul's experiential perspective. Lost, abandoned, crying, God has forgotten me. One evokes divine mercy, the other assigns fault. Different spiritualities entirely. The Swami's middle position, opposing changes while denying they matter, is contradiction, not moderation. If they don't matter, why oppose them? If they do matter, why dismiss examination as childish? This reveals institutional self-preservation, 50 years of identity built on certain assumptions. To examine them too closely would require rebuilding that identity. The Swami's response wasn't addressed to her. It was an internal debate he'd been having for years. The medieval scholars had a term for this, double truth. The capacity to hold contradictory positions simultaneously by assigning them to different domains. The institutional response to documented evidence, acknowledge but minimize, oppose but defend, recognize but compartmentalize, not unique to the Swami. Structural. The ordinary way institutions preserve themselves against evidence that threatens foundational narratives. If the defense was structural rather than personal, the solution couldn't be personal either. It would require documentation so thorough that compartmentalization became impossible. The conversation with the Swami was over. The investigation had merely begun. If institutional defenders would compartmentalize the evidence, Maya realized she needed to make the human cost impossible to ignore. The textual differences she had documented were producing measurably different human beings. To understand how deeply the alterations penetrated lived experience, she visited temples across North America, observing how practitioners who read different editions actually lived their spiritual lives. She began in the Midwest at a temple that still used predominantly original editions, many devotees treasuring worn copies from the 1970s. Their gatherings emphasized heart-sharing, emotional fellowship, devotional experiences. Sunday programs felt like extended family reunions where everyone knew everyone's struggles and victories. Leadership operated through inspiration-based charismatic guidance, emphasizing grace. The temple president often began announcements by asking, "How can we support each other's spiritual journeys?" Teaching happened through storytelling, personal testimony, transformational sharing. When Maya attended their weekly Bhagavad Gita class, she counted 7 personal stories and 3 people crying during the discussion of one verse. When she witnessed 2 families feuding over a minor misunderstanding, Maya watched the temple president sit both families down and ask each person to share how they felt, not what they thought the other person had done wrong. Emotional healing, forgiveness emphasis, heart opening. The community goals, evident in every conversation, centered on shared divine love, mutual spiritual support, collective devotional growth. The spiritual culture was unmistakably mystical orientation, grace dependence, heart-centered practices. Maya interviewed 20 Midwest practitioners about their responses to recent spiritual crises: illness, job loss, relationship collapse, existential despair. They described internal processes like, "Blessed Lord, I am lost, please help me." Direct appeals to divine intervention. Their community had responded with emotional support, prayer fellowship, shared vulnerability. One woman described how 15 people showed up at her apartment after her divorce, not to give advice, but to sit with her and cry together. Resolution came through grace-seeking, surrender practices, heart-opening. Their recovery pattern involved divine intervention expectation and relationship healing emphasis. Long-term integration meant deeper devotional dependence and enhanced divine intimacy. The divorced woman told Maya, "I'm closer to Krishna now than ever before. He was all I had left, and that was enough." A temple on the West Coast, by contrast, used exclusively revised editions, purchasing new copies annually for their growing membership of graduate students and young professionals. Their gatherings emphasized educational format, methodical discussion, knowledge sharing. Sunday programs felt like religious studies seminars with question and answer periods and homework assignments. Leadership operated through authority-based educational guidance emphasizing knowledge. The temple president began announcements by reviewing essential philosophical principles for spiritual development. Teaching happened through lecture format, analytical discussion, structured instruction. When Maya attended their weekly Bhagavad Gita class, the instructor used a whiteboard to diagram the relationship between different categories of material elements. 20 West Coast practitioners interviewed about spiritual crises described internal processes like, "I need better understanding of proper spiritual principles," appeals to better knowledge. Their community had responded with educational resources, structured guidance, methodological support. One man described receiving a carefully curated reading list and weekly check-in meetings with a mentor to discuss his application of philosophical principles to his situation. Resolution came through knowledge-seeking, methodical application, proper technique. Their recovery pattern involved personal improvement expectation and progressive development emphasis. Long-term integration meant enhanced competence and improved methodological application. The man told Maya, "I understand so much more now about how material nature works and how to navigate it properly." Both had recovered, both had grown, but they had become fundamentally different types of spiritual practitioners, and neither realized they were reading different books. Whether the additions shaped the communities or different communities naturally gravitated toward additions matching their existing orientations remained an open question. Maya suspected both forces were at work. Textual influence and selective affinity reinforcing each other over time. What remained undeniable was the correlation itself. Wherever original editions predominated, heart-centered communities emerged. Wherever revisions predominated, knowledge-centered communities developed. Maya's research extended to interfaith contexts when she attended a series of dialogues between Hindu, Christian, and Buddhist practitioners organized by Stanford's Religious Studies Department. The speaker representing Krishna consciousness from the Midwest Temple brought her worn original edition and spoke in heart-centered sharing and devotional testimony, finding mystical commonality with the Sufi Muslim speaker who quoted Rumi and the Catholic contemplative who referenced Teresa of Avila. They discovered shared divine love emphasis, universal heart connection, grace traditions that transcended theological differences. The dialogue method emphasized emotional authenticity, spiritual experience sharing, heart-level connection, all three speakers crying at one point while describing their encounters with the divine. The Krishna devotees' conversion approach, if it could be called that, worked through inspirational sharing, devotional attraction, heart-opening invitation. She invited people to come experience the love of God without requiring them to understand Vedic philosophy first. The speaker from the West Coast Temple brought a pristine revised edition and approached interfaith dialogue through academic presentation, formal theology, intellectual dialogue. He found common ground with the Buddhist scholar who discussed the Abhidharma and the Presbyterian theologian who referenced doctrinal frameworks. They bonded over shared methodical approaches, universal knowledge seeking, educational traditions. The dialogue method emphasized intellectual analysis, theological comparison, rigorous understanding, all three speakers taking notes and citing sources. The Krishna devotees' conversion approach worked through educational presentation, intellectual attraction, knowledge-based invitation. He invited people to study the science of self-realization with a recommended reading list. Both approaches found their audiences, but the other panelists had no idea there were two versions of the Bhagavad Gita as it is, creating these different spiritual worlds. Dr. Patricia Williamson, chair of Stanford's Religious Studies Department, said it plainly over lunch at the faculty club. The original gives us access to what Prabhupada actually thought and felt, messy, passionate, occasionally grammatically imperfect, but spiritually alive. The revision gives us what his organization wants us to think he should have said. Polished, precise, academically respectable, but spiritually sanitized. For studying living mystical traditions, I want the original. For teaching systematic Hindu theology, I'd use the revision. But presenting them as the same text, that's scholarly malpractice. The most disturbing discovery came when Maya observed how parents transmitted spirituality to children. She spent a week with the Kumar family on the West Coast, first-generation immigrants who had purchased revised editions when joining the temple. Rajesh Kumar, a software engineer at Google, approached evening prayers the way he approached code. Systematically, precisely, with clear documentation. In the evening, he and his 7-year-old son Arjun sat in their home shrine room with the revised Bhagavad Gita. Chapter 4, verse 11, Rajesh announced, opening to his bookmark. Tonight we study the reciprocation principle. Arjun read the Sanskrit first. The boy stumbled through the Devanagari script while his father corrected pronunciation. Then Rajesh read the translation. As all surrender unto me, I reward them accordingly. Everyone follows my path in all respects, O son of Pritha. What does reciprocation mean? Rajesh asked. When Krishna gives back what people give him? Correct. Now, what are the four types of consciousness mentioned in the purport? Rajesh had highlighted them in yellow. Let's review the philosophical categories. For 40 minutes, father and son worked through theological frameworks, Sanskrit pronunciation, logical categorizations. Arjun could explain the difference between bhakti yoga and karma yoga. He knew that the Supreme Personality of Godhead manifested in various incarnations according to precise principles. But when Arjun's hamster died 3 days later, the child stood in the shrine room doorway, tears streaming. Papa, can we ask Krishna to take care of Squeaky? Rajesh set down his work laptop. Come, Beta. He guided Arjun to the altar. Remember what we learned about the soul? The hamster's Atma, its eternal spiritual essence, has simply transmigrated according to karmic law. The Supreme Personality of Godhead administers these laws with perfect justice. Everything operates according to philosophical categories we studied. But does Krishna know Squeaky's name? The child's voice cracked. Does he know Squeaky liked sunflower seeds? Rajesh opened the revised Bhagavad Gita to chapter 2, the section on the eternal soul. The soul is eternal, unborn, constant. It is not killed when the body is killed. I don't want to know about souls. Arjun's small fist hit his thigh. I want Krishna to remember Squeaky. The father tried harder, explaining transmigration, progressive advancement, the proper philosophical framework for understanding death. All true. All accurate. All somehow missing what the child actually needed. Permission to cry to God, as a friend who cared about dead hamsters and little boy's grief. In 20 years, Maya wrote in her notes that night, Arjun Kumar will either be a methodically competent practitioner who understands theological categories but has never experienced divine intimacy, or he'll have dismissed it all as ethnic culture his parents forced on him. The revised edition had given Rajesh the tools to teach philosophy. It had not given him the language to teach his son how to love God or be loved by God in return. Two books, two approaches to the same tradition. Both creating real practitioners, but were they practitioners of the same spirituality? The tragedy wasn't that both approaches existed. The tragedy was that the Kumars had never been told they were choosing. They had purchased Prabhupada's Bhagavad Gita as it is, the same book Maya's grandmother had given her, and received something fundamentally different. Somewhere in the Midwest, another family was reading about the Blessed Lord to their 6-year-old daughter, teaching her to pray when sad, to thank Krishna for simple joys. That child was learning that divine love welcomed her exactly as she was, grief, hamsters, and all. Would these two children, raised on different editions of the same book, even recognize each other as practitioners of the same tradition? The version determines the spiritual trajectory. The text shapes the soul, and buyers of Bhagavad Gita as it is deserve to know which path they were actually purchasing. But how had they concealed this for 40 years while claiming to serve Prabhupada's legacy? The institutional response would reveal their strategies. Maya was about to discover exactly how that rhetorical strategy worked, and why it had succeeded for so long. Armed with what David Matthews had revealed about the publishing process, Maya arranged a meeting with Dr. Richard Whitfield, Ritampara Das, a senior BBT representative who had publicly defended the revisions for 2 decades. They met at the BBT offices in Los Angeles, a modern building filled with Sanskrit texts and photographs of Prabhupada. As Maya entered Whitfield's office, she noticed the man's genuine reverence, photos of him with various spiritual teachers, Sanskrit dictionaries worn from use, devotional texts in multiple languages. This wasn't a corporate executive. This was someone who had dedicated his life to spiritual service. Ms. Rodriguez, Dr. Whitfield greeted her formally, but Maya caught something in his eyes, perhaps a flicker of the same uncertainty she'd seen in her own mirror. I understand you have questions about our editorial process. It struck Maya that this man had probably asked himself the same questions she was asking him. Maya opened her notebook, now thick with documentation. I have evidence of widespread alteration affecting the overwhelming majority of verses. How do you justify this? What followed would be a masterclass in institutional defense mechanisms. The first 15 minutes were predictable institutional deflection. Dr. Whitfield employed every standard defense. These are minor editorial improvements, not substantial changes. Maya spread her statistical analysis across his desk. 541 verses out of 700. You call that minor? We improved Sanskrit accuracy, scholarly apparatus, editorial professionalism. You packaged technical improvements with theological revision, Maya interrupted. Why couldn't you fix diacritical marks without systematically changing the divine address from intimate to formal? You could have created a scholar's edition, clearly labeled. Instead, you replaced the original and hid the changes. The institution authorized these revisions. The GBC approved. Maya pulled out a photograph of Prabhupada. This man had spiritual realization. He chose specific words for specific reasons. Your committees had what? Good English degrees? There's a difference between administrative competence and spiritual realization. You've confused the two. Dr. Whitfield's jaw tightened, but Maya saw something shift in his eyes. Not surrender, but recognition that she had done her homework. Dr. Whitfield played his strongest card. Prabhupada wanted these changes but didn't have time to implement them. Maya had been waiting for this claim. She pulled out a thick folder labeled Class Transcripts. Let's examine your claims one by one, Maya said. You say there were unpublished instructions. Can you show me one letter where Prabhupada asked for Blessed Lord to be changed to Supreme Personality of Godhead? The principle was established through his corrections to other drafts are drafts, Dr. Whitfield. Publication represents the author's final decision, doesn't it? In ideal circumstances, yes, but he had 5 years from 1972 until 1977. Are you saying that wasn't enough time? The situation was complex. Then explain, if he was such a perfectionist, why did he approve the 1972 edition for publication? Stop, let me show you what I have. She opened the class transcripts. Maya pulled out the first transcript, dated December 16, 1968. A devotee reads verse 2.48 aloud. Be steadfast in yoga. Perform your duty with evenness of mind. Prabhupada emphasizes these exact concepts in his class. No correction. No request for changes. She slid another transcript across his desk. 1974 lecture on verse 6.31. Listen to what he says. Worships me. This is bhakti yoga, direct worship of Krishna. He approved that translation. You later changed it to worshipful service of the supersoul, redirecting personal devotion to impersonal meditation. Another transcript. March 1975, verse 2.30. Prabhupada repeats the word eternal 5 times in his class, emphasizing the soul's eternal nature. The revision removed it. Maya looked up from the documents. From 1972 until his departure in 1977, that's 1,825 consecutive days, Prabhupada used his published Bhagavad Gita without requesting any of your comprehensive changes. Dr. Whitfield was sweating now. If Prabhupada wanted these changes, where are the letters requesting alterations? Where are the class corrections? Where are the instructions to editors? Where are the meeting notes? He mentioned things privately. Privately to whom? Where's the documentation? You've changed a published book based on undocumented private conversations? Modern drafts reveal Prabhupada's true theological intentions. We have manuscripts showing what he really wanted. Let me understand. Unpublished drafts override published books? You know better than Prabhupada what he meant? He would approve changes he never requested? A long silence. Dr. Whitfield, in any field, history, literature, science, what's the primary source, the published work or the draft? Silence. When Prabhupada published the Bhagavad Gita in 1972, that was his final editorial decision. You're saying unpublished drafts override published decisions? You found isolated instances where Prabhupada crossed out phrases in drafts. From this, you concluded comprehensive theological revision was authorized. He used Blessed Lord in the published book. He taught from it for 5 years. That's the pattern. Every author has drafts with crossed out words. The publication is what they decided to keep. You're cherry-picking draft evidence while ignoring 5 years of him using the published version. Dr. Whitfield, would you rewrite Shakespeare because you found a draft where he crossed out to be or not to be? Would you improve Beethoven's Ninth Symphony because you found a rejected draft? Religious texts are somehow less deserving of preservation? If anything, they deserve more protection. If you believe your version is better, why not be honest? Call it Bhagavad Gita as it is, BBT Revised Edition. Let people choose. Dr. Whitfield's answer revealed everything. That would confuse people. No, it would inform them. And that's what you're afraid of. Maya showed her final evidence. When Prabhupada wanted changes, look at his pattern. She read from her notes. 1970. I am sending the necessary Sanskrit corrections. 1971. So, when these corrections are made, then you can print. 1973. That regulated should be rejected. Please correct. She looked up. Immediate. Specific. Clear. If he wanted comprehensive divine address changes, he had 1,825 days to request them. He didn't. Dr. Whitfield was silent for a long moment, staring at the photograph of Prabhupada on his desk. When he looked up, his institutional mask had slipped slightly. You know, he said quietly. There are nights I lie awake wondering if we made the right choice. 20 years ago, I believed we were serving Prabhupada. Now, he paused. But then I think about the thousands who found spiritual life through our version. Are you asking me to tell them their development is invalid? We're not destroying Prabhupada's work. We're fulfilling it. The revision represents his mature theological vision, what he would have wanted if he'd had time. Dr. Whitfield tried one more approach. Ms. Rodriguez, you're looking at this through an idealized lens. He spoke of Prabhupada's final years, illness, institutional pressures, thousands of pages of manuscripts. Should we have abandoned that material, or completed what he intended? He showed manuscript pages with Prabhupada's handwriting. These aren't drafts. These are late-stage proofs. Every writer refines their work. Did he ask you to replace the published edition with these manuscripts? Maya asked. Did he say, after I die, use these instead of what I approved? That's what I thought. You made that decision for him. Dr. Whitfield pulled his final card. With all due respect, you're not initiated. You're an outside academic. Do you think you understand Prabhupada's intentions better than his direct disciples? I was there. You've read transcripts. We lived it. Appeal to authority. The classic fallacy when evidence runs thin. Dr. Whitfield, you're right. I'm not initiated. I didn't know Prabhupada. But that's exactly why we need objective evidence. If his direct disciples disagree, and they do, given the lawsuits, then the only neutral arbiter is what he actually published and used for 5 years. Not what you remember, what he approved in print and taught from repeatedly. He chose Blessed Lord. He chose steadfast in yoga. He taught from those choices for 5 years, never once requested them changed. Here's my question. If your justifications are so strong, why not publish both versions, side by side, and let readers choose? You genuinely believe you're serving his mission. I respect that. But what if serving his mission means preserving his words, not improving them? Dr. Whitfield's expression hardened. I think we're done here. You've clearly already decided what you think. Evidence? He stood, gathering papers. You have correlation, not causation. Different people respond to different styles. That doesn't mean one translation is programming anyone. The pervasive nature demonstrates thorough editorial effort to improve fidelity to the Sanskrit, which is exactly what we've said publicly for 40 years. He moved toward the door. I have another meeting. Off the record. Don't you think readers deserve to know both versions exist? He paused, hand on the doorknob. For a moment, something shifted in his face. Ms. Rodriguez, the BBT's position is documented in our published responses. Our editorial philosophy is transparent. We believe the revised edition more faithfully represents Srila Prabhupada's Sanskrit understanding. If you disagree, publish your findings. Will you respond? The BBT responds to scholarly criticism in scholarly forums. If you publish, we'll consider it. Good day. After leaving, Maya sat in her car. She'd gotten the official position, professional, defensive, giving nothing away. No confession, just institutional stonewalling dressed in scholarly language. His phrase haunted her. If you disagree, publish your findings. Perhaps that was the point. Not convincing institutions to acknowledge what they'd done, but giving readers the information to make their own choices. She called Dr. Sarah Chen. Sarah, I need to write this as a book, not a dissertation. The BBT won't engage, but readers will. What did Whitfield say? Exactly what you'd expect. That's the problem with institutions. They don't confess. They persist. So what now? Now I write it for readers, for people like my grandmother who deserve to know they have a choice. Do you have enough evidence? I have 3 months of documentation, temple ethnography, neuroscience research, class transcripts, statistical analysis. I have everything except a confession, and apparently that's not how institutions work. Then write it. Make the case. Let readers decide. As Maya drove home, she thought about millions of readers worldwide, unknowingly choosing between two spiritual orientations. No dramatic conspiracy. No villainous confession. just editorial changes implemented by sincere people who believed they were improving fidelity to Sanskrit, and in the process transformed how readers encountered the divine. The answer wouldn't come from institutions acknowledging what they'd done. It would come from readers making conscious, informed choices. But first, Maya needed to answer the final question. What did Prabhupada actually want? The defenders claimed he privately wanted these changes. The historical record would reveal the truth. The most crucial question, what did Prabhupada actually want for his Bhagavad Gita? The institutional defense claims he privately wanted extensive posthumous changes. The historical record, comprehensive, documented, decisive, reveals something entirely different. Maya Rodriguez had documented thorough textual transformation. Now she needed to examine the evidence that would answer this question definitively. From 1972 until his departure in 1977, Prabhupada used his published Bhagavad Gita, As It Is, for 1,825 consecutive days without requesting any of the comprehensive changes implemented posthumously. Think about what this means practically. For 5 years, he gave hundreds of lectures directly reading from the published edition. He heard devotees read verses aloud thousands of times in exactly the form later changed. He referenced specific verses and page numbers from the published text in correspondence, cited it as his authorized spiritual presentation, used it for his personal daily reading and spiritual reference. If he had wanted comprehensive divine address changes, he had 5 years and countless opportunities to request them. More tellingly, when Prabhupada wanted textual changes, his approach was immediate and explicit. A 1970 letter demonstrates the pattern. I have gone through the blueprint, and I am also sending the necessary Sanskrit corrections to Pradyumna, so when these corrections are made, then you can print immediately. Changes were implemented within days or weeks. He identified exactly what needed modification and how. He followed up to verify that requested changes were properly implemented. This pattern of immediate, specific, verifiable change requests is completely absent regarding any comprehensive theological alterations. The most devastating evidence arrived on a Tuesday afternoon, delivered not through institutional documents, but through the patient work of devotees who had spent years digitizing Prabhupada's recorded lectures. Maya had requested access to class transcripts from 1972 to 1977, the 5 years when Prabhupada taught using his published Bhagavad Gita. What she discovered in those transcripts would provide documented approval of content that was later changed, evidence that would make posthumous revision claims impossible to sustain. Picture the scene she reconstructed from audio recordings, morning classes in temples across the world, Prabhupada seated before his students, a devotee reading aloud from the published book while the teacher listened, eyes closed, absorbing not just words, but the transmission they carried. These weren't casual readings. These were formal instruction, recorded and preserved, creating an inadvertent archive of approval. The pattern Maya had documented in verses 2.48 and 6.31 repeated across dozens more verses. She found another striking example in verse 2.67. One transcript particularly haunted Maya's investigation. A 1974 class on verse 2.67, the reader's voice clear on the recording. One who is not in transcendental consciousness can have neither a controlled mind nor steady intelligence. Prabhupada's response came immediately, emphatic. Everyone in this material world, they are after peace, but they don't want to control the senses. We do not know how to control the senses. We do not know the real yogic principle of controlling the senses. Maya checked the revised edition. The phrase controlled mind had been removed, the very concept Prabhupada had emphasized when hearing this verse read aloud from the published text he had personally approved. She began cataloging these instances, and the evidence accumulated into a devastating indictment. Prabhupada had heard the original translations in hundreds of lectures. He had explicitly approved them through his teaching commentary. He had often emphasized the very concepts later deleted in revision. He had never, not once in 5 years and thousands of teaching hours, requested the systematic changes implemented after his death. He taught from and expanded upon the exact formulations later corrected by editors who claimed to be serving his intentions. The archive yielded another category of evidence that made Maya pause mid-research, forcing her to step away from her laptop and simply sit with what she had found. These were Prabhupada's explicit warnings about posthumous changes to his work. So you cannot change anything. The quote appeared in a 1976 discussion about maintaining his books exactly as published. The context was unambiguous. His disciples were to preserve, not improve. A 1975 letter to his editors carried equal clarity. These things should be corrected by editorial revision, but the sense should remain the same. He authorized correction of technical errors, grammar, spelling, perhaps awkward phrasing, but explicitly required maintaining the sense. This was precisely what comprehensive theological revision violated. You could fix a typo. You could not redirect readers from personal devotion to impersonal philosophy and claim you were maintaining the sense. But the most prophetic warning appeared in a letter dated September 18, 1976, 14 months before his death, to a disciple named Dixit Das. Maya read it three times, each reading making the hair on her arms rise. A little learning is dangerous, especially for the Westerners. I am practically seeing that as soon as they begin to learn a little Sanskrit, immediately they feel that they have become more than their guru, and then the policy is kill guru and be killed himself. Kill guru. The phrase seemed melodramatic until Maya considered what it meant to comprehensively alter a spiritual teacher's completed work based on the presumption that one's Sanskrit knowledge revealed what he really meant better than his own published books. Was that not, in a very real sense, killing the guru, replacing his spiritual vision with one's own scholarly interpretation? This described exactly what occurred in the posthumous revision process. Editors with Sanskrit knowledge, real but limited, presuming to correct their teacher's theological presentation in a work he had reviewed, approved, and used for 5 years without requesting such changes. The warning proved prophetic. Maya found herself thinking about the book's title, Bhagavad Gita as it is. Not as scholars think it should be. Not as committees improved it. As it is. Meaning as the text actually presents spiritual truth, direct and unfiltered by institutional improvement processes. Everything in Prabhupada's documented behavior pointed toward this interpretation. His consistent choice of intimate, accessible language over formal theological precision reflected conscious spiritual methodology, not linguistic limitation. His life's work focused on making authentic spiritual knowledge accessible to sincere seekers through clear, heart-opening presentation. His warnings about disciples becoming more than their guru indicated clear concern about precisely the kind of posthumous editorial presumption that eventually occurred. Maya created what she privately called the documentary absence test, searching the historical record for evidence that would support posthumous revision claims. If Prabhupada had wanted systematic theological revision, the archive should contain letters requesting terminology changes, classes where he corrected published formulations, meetings where he authorized systematic alterations, written instructions about preferred alternative wordings. The historical record was silent. No such documentation existed. If he had been dissatisfied with his published theological presentation, the archive should show complaints about it, requests for fundamental reconceptualization, expressions of regret about publication decisions, instructions to delay further printing until revisions could be completed. Again, silence. No evidence of dissatisfaction with published theological content. If he had intended posthumous editorial revision, there should be instructions giving specific people authority to revise his completed work, guidelines for posthumous editorial decision-making, approval of committee-based theological processes, permission for systematic alteration of spiritual content. Once more, nothing. While Prabhupada authorized specific changes when he was present and could personally review them, he never granted permission for comprehensive posthumous editorial revision of completed works. Maya found herself conducting a thought experiment that felt morbid but necessary. Based on his documented positions and behavior patterns, how would Prabhupada have reacted to discovering posthumous systematic revision of his Bhagavad Gita? His pattern throughout his life was direct, immediate response to unauthorized changes to his work. The fury that shocked his disciples 3 months before his death, when he discovered alterations to another publication, demonstrated this. He would have identified exactly which changes violated his spiritual intentions and required restoration. He would have clarified the difference between correcting technical errors and altering spiritual content. His life's work emphasized giving people authentic spiritual choice, not committee-filtered alternatives. The historical evidence provided clear judgment. Prabhupada approved his published Bhagavad Gita as it is, as complete. He authorized it for widespread distribution without systematic theological revision. He used it successfully for 5 years. He explicitly warned against the kind of posthumous improvement that eventually occurred. The institutional defense collapsed under this weight of documentation. 5 years of satisfied use. Hundreds of classes teaching from the published edition. Explicit preservation warnings. No authorization for systematic revision. The claim that he privately wanted comprehensive changes, but somehow never mentioned them in thousands of hours of recorded teaching, hundreds of letters to editors, or 5 years of daily use became impossible to sustain. The evidence revealed, Prabhupada wanted authentic preservation, not theological replacement. His hard-accessible methodology, intimate divine language, grace-dependent spiritual anthropology, emotional accessibility, represented conscious spiritual design, not limitation requiring scholarly correction. The solution seemed obvious to Maya, though apparently it had eluded institutional authorities for 4 decades. Preserve the original for those seeking Prabhupada's authentic methodology. Offer the revision for those preferring systematic theological precision. Ensure clear identification of both versions. Enable conscious choice rather than institutional substitution. Prabhupada wanted his Bhagavad Gita preserved as it is, exactly as he published it after 5 years of satisfied use and documented approval. The historical evidence was overwhelming, but evidence alone couldn't answer the question that had driven Maya from the beginning. What would she tell her grandmother? Maya had discovered the truth about stolen words. Now she needed to find the words to tell it. The hospital room looked different this time, starker, more clinical. Her grandmother had been discharged after that first hospitalization in the spring, had spent 3 months at home continuing her daily readings. But the illness had returned with unexpected aggression, and now she was back. 3 months since that first conversation about verse 6.31. 3 months of Maya's investigation, while her grandmother read both books at home, marking passages, writing marginal notes, waiting for answers. Maya's grandmother lay propped against pillows, her worn 1972 edition of the Bhagavad Gita resting on the blanket beside her. The book's spine was cracked, its pages soft from decades of handling, corners dog-eared to mark verses that had sustained her through her husband's death, her daughter's rebellion, her own long illness. Next to it, almost obscenely pristine by comparison, sat Maya's 2023 printing, the book that had sparked this entire investigation. "Tell me what you found, Miha," her grandmother said, and though her voice was weaker than it had been in the spring, her eyes were sharp. She had been waiting for this conversation. Maya pulled a chair close to the bed. For 3 months, she'd been documenting, analyzing, interviewing, measuring, approaching her grandmother's question with all the analytical precision of her graduate training. Now, facing the woman whose confusion had launched her into this investigation, she found that all her careful documentation suddenly felt insufficient. "Abuela, you weren't confused. The books really are different. Not just verse 6.31, almost everything." Her grandmother's hand reached for Maya's, the grip surprisingly strong. "I knew it. For months I thought I was losing my mind, that the cancer was affecting my memory. But I knew these words. I've read this book every morning for over 50 years. Maya explained it all. The extensive changes, the systematic patterns, the neurological research, the global confusion. She explained how her grandmother's forgotten soul had been transformed into forgetful soul, how the blessed Lord she had prayed to for decades had become the supreme personality of Godhead, how the editors had believed they were improving Prabhupada's work but had actually created 2 completely different spiritual paths. "Which one is right?" her grandmother asked, and Maya recognized the question as a trap, the same trap she had fallen into at the beginning of her investigation. "Neither. Both. Abuela, that's what took me 3 months to understand. The original creates people like you, devoted, heart-centered, seeking grace and relationship. The revision creates people like the temple president's son, the one who lectures everyone about proper philosophical understanding. Both are sincere, both are valuable. But they're fundamentally different paths, and nobody told readers they were choosing." Her grandmother was quiet for a long moment, her fingers tracing the familiar cover of her old edition. "So I can keep reading my book?" You should keep reading your book. It's authentic to Prabhupada. It's authentic to you. The problem isn't that the revision exists. It's that they hid the fact that they made a choice for millions of people who deserve to make that choice themselves. What will you do with all your research, Miha? Will you write about it? Maya looked at the notebooks and printouts she had brought. 3 months of investigation compressed into evidence that simultaneously proved everything and resolved nothing. I'm going to publish it. Not just as an academic paper, though Dr. Chen thinks I should submit to journals, as a book. Something that ordinary people can read, so they can understand what happened and make their own choices. They'll be angry with you. The temple authorities. Probably. Some already are. But Abuela, someone has to say it. Millions of people are reading these books, building their lives around them, never knowing that what they're receiving was systematically altered 40 years ago. That's not right. Not for you. Not for them. Not for Prabhupada's memory. Her grandmother smiled, and for a moment Maya glimpsed the woman beneath the illness, the one who had introduced her to Krishna consciousness 2 decades earlier, fierce, loving, uncompromising in her devotion. Your grandfather would be proud. He always said truth matters more than comfort. They sat in companionable silence as afternoon light slanted through the hospital window. Maya noticed her grandmother had marked a verse, 2.25 in the original edition, the verse about the unchangeable soul that had been systematically stripped of that very quality in the revision. Her grandmother had written in the margin, in her careful hand, "Krishna promises I am eternal. This gives me courage." Maya understood, with sudden clarity, what her 3 months of investigation had really been about. It wasn't just textual scholarship or neuroscience or preserving Prabhupada's legacy, it was about her grandmother's right to keep that marginal note meaningful. It was about ensuring that future grandmothers could write similar notes in margins that wouldn't contradict them a generation later. Abuela, can I ask you something? During all these months while I've been researching, while I've been so focused on documentation and evidence, have you kept reading? Every morning, same verses I've been reading for over 50 years. They still speak to me, Miha. Even knowing about the other version, even understanding what you've discovered, these words are home. They shaped how I love Krishna. They shaped how I pray. They shaped how I face. She gestured vaguely at the hospital equipment surrounding her. All of this. Maya felt tears she had been suppressing for months finally surface. I've been so angry. At the editors, at the institution, at everyone who knew about these changes and said nothing. But sitting here with you, seeing how your book has sustained you, I realize my anger has been misplaced. The original isn't just better, in some abstract sense. It's yours. It belongs to you, and millions like you. And taking it away, or replacing it without warning, or pretending the replacement is the same thing. That's the real theft. So you'll write your book? I'll write it. I'll document everything. I'll show people exactly what happened. And then I'll let them choose, consciously, which path serves their spiritual journey. Her grandmother squeezed Maya's hand. And which will you choose, Miha? For yourself? Maya looked at both books lying on the hospital blanket. Identical titles containing fundamentally different spiritual universes. The question her grandmother had asked 3 months ago, "Can you explain this verse?" had taken her through comparative theology, neuroscience, global ethnography, institutional politics, and the complexity of her own spiritual identity. She had discovered how words program consciousness, how institutions shape souls, how editorial choices determine spiritual destinies, but she still had to choose which spiritual reality to inhabit. I think I need both, actually. The words surprised her as she said them. 3 months ago, she would have demanded a single right answer. Which book was authentic? Which path was correct? Which version God truly wanted her to read? That binary thinking had been its own kind of programming. The original for my heart, for when I need to feel that grace and intimacy and surrender that first drew me to this path. The revision for my mind, for when I need systematic understanding and intellectual framework. But I'll keep them both visible, both available. I'll never pretend they're the same thing. And I'll teach others to make the same conscious choice. She had begun this investigation angry at institutional deception. She was ending it grateful for consciousness itself, the capacity to recognize how words shaped her, and then to choose which shaping she needed, moment by moment. That was a different kind of spiritual practice than she'd understood before. More honest. More awake. That's wisdom, Miha. Real wisdom. Not choosing one and rejecting the other, but understanding what each offers and when you need each one. Her grandmother paused, then added with a slight smile, "Though personally, I'm keeping my old book. At my age, I don't need new words. The old ones have served me well." They talked until visiting hours ended, about verses and memories, and the peculiar comfort of discovering that your confusion was actually clarity about a real problem. When Maya finally stood to leave, her grandmother said, "One more thing. This book you're writing, don't just tell them what happened. Tell them why it matters. Tell them about this." She gestured at the two books, at the hospital room, at the whole strange situation. "Tell them that words matter because they shape how we love God, how we understand ourselves, how we face death. Tell them that taking away someone's spiritual words without warning is like changing the prayers they've been saying for over 50 years. It's theft of the most intimate kind." Maya promised she would. Walking out of the hospital, Maya realized her investigation was both complete and just beginning. She had documented the theft, understood its mechanisms, traced its consequences across continents and decades. Now came the harder part, teaching millions of readers to recognize what had been stolen from them, and giving them back the choice that should never have been taken away. Her grandmother passed away 3 weeks later, the original 1972 Bhagavad Gita on her bedside table, open to her favorite verse about the unchangeable soul. At the memorial service, Maya read from that same verse, using the words her grandmother had known, the words that had sustained her, the words that editors had decided to replace with better alternatives, the words that Maya's book would help preserve for future generations who deserve to know what their grandmothers had read. Maya kept finding herself back in one specific memory from childhood, her grandmother's kitchen on Saturday mornings, the smell of fresh chapatis, Indian tortillas, mixing with copal incense, the yellow formica countertop where Maya would do homework while her grandmother made breakfast. Her grandmother would chant the Hare Krishna mantra while rolling dough, 16 rounds, 108 repetitions per round, the same rhythm she used for shaping chapatis. "The mantra and the cooking are the same," she had explained once. "Both are offerings, both require attention, both feed something essential." Maya had been maybe 12 years old, impatient with what seemed like primitive magical thinking. Now, 20 years later, she understood. Her grandmother had been teaching her that the sacred and the ordinary occupied the same space, that the words used for either one mattered equally. That memory, flower dust on weathered hands, Hare Krishna synchronized with the slap of dough against griddle, the matter-of-fact holiness of Saturday morning, contained everything Maya's investigation had tried to prove. The words we use while living our lives shape the lives themselves. Change the words, change the world. Her grandmother had known this all along. The investigation was over. The work of restoration was just beginning. This entire investigation ends exactly where it began, with a grandmother in a hospital bed asking about a single verse. Except now, 3 months and hundreds of pages later, we understand that the question, "Can you explain this verse?" was never really a question at all. It was an invitation into a labyrinth where every answer revealed 7 new corridors, where every discovery doubled back on itself. The map had systematically replaced the territory while claiming to represent it. Maya's grandmother is gone now, but her confusion, that beautiful, sacred confusion about verse 6.31, turned out to be the most spiritually accurate response possible to what had been done. She knew the text had been stolen. She just didn't know how to prove it. This book is that proof. But like all proofs in labyrinths, it raises more questions than it resolves. Somewhere, another grandmother is reading her Bhagavad Gita, noticing that the words feel different than she remembers, wondering if her memory is failing. This book is for her. Somewhere, a young scholar is about to discover that the edition they've been citing for years isn't the same as the edition their professor uses. This book is for them. Somewhere, an editor believes they're improving a sacred text when they're actually programming human consciousness. This book is for them too, though they may never forgive it. The words that shape souls deserve to be chosen consciously, not stolen quietly. That's the only certainty 3 months of investigation revealed. Everything else, which version is better, which path is right, which future is authentic, remains as it should, a choice each reader must make for themselves. Maya's choice, in the end, was simply to give them back the choice itself.